All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Pro Photo Show. It is episode 90 on January 24th. Good to have you here. I'm Gavin Syme. We got a great panel today, and we're going to have some fun. We're going to talk about kind of the latest things coming into the new year, what's happening in the industry, share some ideas, some tips about things we're going to be working on this year, and just kind of try and get us excited a bit about what's coming in 2013.
Welcome to Pro Photo Show, the resource for professional and enthusiast photographers, a member of the Blueberry Network and the Tech Podcast Network. For show notes, tips, forums, and more, visit us online at profotoshow.net.
Okay, so today on our esteemed panel, we have a brand new guest, Brian Caparici. Am I saying that right, Brian?
Oh, I've heard worse. That's pretty good.
Why don't you tell us how to properly say your name and give us just kind of a quick bio.
Yeah, cool. If you want to say it like my noni says it, it's Caparici, but you could say it Caparici. It would be more the North American way of saying it.
Is that Italian then, or...?
No, it's Dutch. No, yeah,
okay,
it's Italian.
Interesting.
No, it's Italian. I'm kidding.
I'm just like, hey, could be Italian.
And thanks for having me, Gavin. I'm up here in the Great White North. I'm in Fonthill, Ontario, not too far away from Niagara Falls there, and pretty close to Toronto as well, about an hour drive there. I've been in business for myself full-time for about 8 years now, focused mostly on portraits and weddings. I'm the chair of our local branch of the Professional Photographers of Canada, so fairly involved in the local industry here and what's happening around here. Back 2 years ago, I received my Craftsman of Photographic Arts. I was youngest photographer in Canada to receive that. So that was pretty cool from PPOC. I co-wrote a book on pricing not too long ago, about a year ago, for photographers.
Cool.
And that's about it. That's me.
Sounds like you're a busy guy.
Yeah.
Hey, great to have you, and it's going to be fun. I know we've been trying to get you on for a while now, and you're always busy. So I said, okay, let's try again.
There you go. Cool. Thanks.
And back from a previous episode, Joseph. It's a hard round of names. Joseph Linoschke.
Hey, that's pretty good as well. There you go.
Now
awesome.
That's not Italian. I don't think that sounds more German to me.
It is German.
Okay. All right.
I could have told you Dutch, though, and that you might have believed, but no, it is German.
I probably would have. Joseph, good to have you. Just real quick, remind people where you're from, what do you do, and what are you up to these days? Good to have you.
Thank you very much. I hail from Ashland, Oregon these days. I am obviously a photographer. The photography side of life is photojoseph.com and photojoseph everywhere you might look. And then I run the world's most popular aperture website. That's aperturexpert.com.
Now, when you say world's most popular, does that mean really the world's most popular?
It really does. It really does.
Is aperture getting more or less popular, though?
More.
How do you feel about that? You think so?
Yep.
Good.
Absolutely.
We need competition, because I've kind of been feeling the opposite, and I'm not knocking on your side at all, because you produce great content. But it seems like Apple, real quick, and then I'm going to get to you, Barry. I want to see what you're up to, but just give a quick input. There seems to be a consensus. It seems like I see more and more people switching to Lightroom, and it seems like Apple is very silent on aperture. Some people saying, hey, you know, where's the new stuff? You know, I mean, it's like the whole Mac Pro fiasco, but for software. Just,
right.
I mean, do you know of anything that's happening, and how does that affect where the software is going? Because I'm not an aperture user myself. It drives me nuts how slow it is. But at the same time, I love aperture being there. We need that competition. We need an alternative. And, you know, I'd love to talk with you sometimes about why it's so slow, because no matter what computer I use it on, it is dog slow for me. And we've talked about this before. But it's a powerful program. And more importantly, Adobe doesn't have any other competition besides aperture. But what's going on with aperture?
That is true. Well, as far as the silence goes, I mean, that's just par for the course with Apple, right? They don't talk about anything. So saying that there's no word from Apple on aperture is like saying there's no word from Apple on the next iPhone. Well, obviously not. That's just not how they do business. The things that I can point to, and I don't have any inside information, and if I did, obviously I couldn't tell you. But what I can tell you, I can point to the same things that I've talked to when I hear this. And unfortunately, I do hear this a lot, and it's understandable. It's been a little while since aperture had a major release.
It's fallen
the last. Yeah, the last release of 3.3 was their last really big one, and even though it wasn't a 4.0, it had a bunch of new features and a bunch of new capabilities and a lot of back-end stuff. So it really was quite a big upgrade. It just didn't have the numbers, so a lot of people didn't go, yay, finally 4 is here. But at the end of the day, the easiest thing to point to say, look, Aperture is not going away, is the advertising, the television advertising that Apple did for both of the Retina MacBook Pros, MacBook Pros, whatever they were. Both of those featured Aperture. And a company as big as Apple doesn't make a mistake like putting in a piece of software that it's about to kill onto a national ad campaign, especially when you consider that they have never, ever featured Aperture or any Pro app in any TV ad campaign before. So now, that right there just tells you.
That's a good point. Now, is it possible, though, that they're leaning it towards that they might, for example, replace iPhoto with Aperture and make it more of a consumer app that's just a powerful bundled kind of app? Or do you think that's unlikely?
I don't think that's likely because there is so much that you can do. The Aperture is so powerful that for your average mom and dad user, grandma, whatever, it's too much. It's scary. Right. It's very easy to use, and they've worked really hard to make it even easier to use than it was before, but it's no iPhoto comes to simplicity.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's face it, iPhoto is a free app that comes with every Mac, and it's a gateway into the bigger world of Aperture. Now, I don't think Apple makes a huge amount of money from Aperture. It's only $79. I mean, how much money can you make off of it? But, of course, it is pure profit once it's sold. I have no idea how many copies are sold or anything like that, but it's doing enough where they keep on paying attention to this market and keep adding features to it. So I'm confident it's there for the long haul.
Right. Very cool. Well, that's good because I like the competition, and while I don't use it actively, I do use it because I make the Lightflow collection and stuff like that for Aperture on SimeFX.com. So it's a powerful program. With that, I'm kind of getting off track here and breaking the rules of being a good host. Barry, let's get to you. Welcome. And for those that might just be hearing you for the first time, which would mean they just have to have got on the show, because Barry, you've been here for, gosh, it seems like almost as long as I have. But what are you doing real quick these days? And tell people where you're at. I know it's probably cold where you're at.
I'm in Minnesota. It's supposed to be cold. I mean, that's just the way it goes. But it's like living in Canada. Sometimes you just get a little, you get a little winter, you get a little snow, and it's a good thing.
Right.
I'm just kind of doing my thing. My big thing has been the last 30 days or so, I've really been in Operation Rebrand, my wedding category.
Right.
I have kind of fallen off the map a little with wedding bookings, and that's disturbing at a lot of levels. So I'm kind of coming off the rope, swinging a little bit, and kind of doing some pretty high-end work to try and sort of recapture some of that. And we may get a chance to talk about some of that later on in the show.
Excellent. Very cool. Okay, and let us jump in to just touching real quick. I don't have a huge amount of thrilling, exciting news, but let's pop in there and see if any of you guys have anything you want to hit on that's been happening in the news. Why don't I just, Joseph, we've talked about Aperture, no really new news there, but do you have any of you guys, do you have anything in the news that's interesting to you lately?
Goodness.
Yeah, I'll share something quickly. It's not exactly entirely 100% new, and it actually is a little bit relevant to sort of what you're hoping to talk about today, Gavin. But back in November, there were some pretty big changes to the copyright law for Canadian photographers.
Okay. Yeah, shout out to those, because I'm totally unfamiliar with Canadian copyright law.
Yeah, I'm honestly not educated probably to the point where I should be on it, but basically we've joined the likes of musicians and other artists where by default we own the copyright to the work that we create, whereas before the person who commissioned us to create the photograph owned the copyright to it, unless explicitly stated in a contract. So,
okay, interesting.
That's a huge change, because the last time that was updated was 1998. And prior to that, it was like 1965 or something crazy like that. So that was a pretty big change. I know PPOC was really involved with that, and so was CAPIC. So that's a huge victory for Canadian photographers.
Excellent. Very cool. So basically that brings you relatively on par with U.S. copyright law. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, the way I understand it, it's about on par now. Yeah.
Right. Okay, cool. We may come back to the copyright topic in the lightning rounds and just talk a little bit about how people handle copyright, how each of us deal with copyright concerns in terms of registration and things like that. So let's put that one on hold so we can kind of stay on topic. In terms of other news, if anybody's shuffling around back there, feel free to look for anything that's exciting that you've noticed lately. But Imaging USA was this week, of course, so that's one of the biggest photo conferences of the year. And I believe that just ended. So shout out to those of you guys that made it to that. I did not make it this year, but I went last year. It was pretty amazing. So it's not really a news convention so much as a photographer's convention. To be honest, I haven't seen anything completely earth-shattering. Lots of point-and-shoots being announced, and Nikon has some photo cloud storage going on, you know, that kind of stuff. But nothing thrilling, nothing blowing my mind. So does anybody else have anything newsworthy that they want to bring up? And if there's nothing really happening in the news, we'll move on to other things.
You know, that Canon introduced at CES, that little PowerShot N, I think it's called, the kind of weird squarish little camera that's where you can turn the dial to take the picture. You guys seen this one?
Not the M, not the EOS M. You're not talking about that.
N as in Nancy.
Okay, interesting.
It's a point and shoot. This is a little, you know, it's basically a tag on to your iPhone. The whole idea there is that it has Instagram like effects built into it. You take a picture and then it will produce a series of effects on a photo at once. And it's not only just going to produce a series of, so you'll see multiple versions. You'll see, like, I don't know, five or something different versions of your photo. But apparently it uses some kind of algorithm where it looks at the photo and determines what effects might look best on it. And obviously you can change them afterwards, but it gives you kind of five recommendations.
Fascinating.
And then it has this easy one-button connection to your phone so that you can transmit the photo and then send it, post it to Instagram or Facebook, whatever you want. So you still do that from your phone. So basically you have this higher quality camera than what's built into your phone that you can instantly transfer photos over to your device to send and share. And that part of it's really cool. But the thing that really intrigues me about this camera is every single photo you take, it captures 4 seconds of video prior to that photo being taken. So it's constantly recording, keeping a 4-second cache, and you hit the button and it saves the last 4 seconds. And apparently what it does, and this is all just from me reading about it, I haven't actually seen the thing myself. Apparently what it does is it then takes, at the end of the day, it takes those 4-second montages and puts them together into a little video summary of your day.
Huh.
So every time you pick up the camera and point it at someone, you got 4 seconds of video of them going, hey, getting ready to pose or whatever, and then the picture, and then you move on. And it's really interesting. I haven't played with this. I don't know how useful or how good it is, but I like the idea, and I got to give some credit to Canon for thinking a little bit outside the box on this one. This is definitely an interesting foray into point and shoot, and they're clearly going after that loss of market to people who are just carrying cell phones and using that as their exclusive camera.
Trying to do something more to keep the point and shoot market alive, as it were. Do you know the model of it? Because when I'm searching EOS N, I'm not finding anything.
PowerShot N.
PowerShot N. Okay.
PowerShot N.
And we'll look that up and link it in the show notes. Do you know if it's available now?
No, it's coming up fairly soon. Let's see here. Price is $299, and I think it's within the next couple of months. Looking on JNR.
Interesting.
You can pre-order it. It doesn't say when it's actually going to ship on here. But it was quite soon. They showed it at CES, and I think it was going to come within the next month or two.
My question is to you guys with point-and-shoots. You know, since we brought up this topic, this is a good one to touch on real quickly. Is the point-and-shoot going to be a market anymore? I mean, I realize Canon's trying to do this fun stuff, but does anybody really care enough when it comes to with a snapshot to want to bother to still carry a camera? I mean, on a realistic consumer level, they've all got these phones now, you know, they got iPhones, they got Androids, and they're getting better all the time, you know, from a consumer level. And I'm not talking about professional photos at all, because I definitely think the serious cameras are still, of course, leading there by far. But in terms of a consumer level, what do you think?
Well, I'll start. I think that the market is going to become less and less relevant, and that's why we're seeing cameras, you know, at least a camera like this that's trying to do something different.
Right.
What was the – is it Sanyo that has the one that's got a whole Android platform built into it? And that's – we saw that at Photokina last year, and it's a little bit weird. I'm not so sure about that camera. It's kind of too much at once.
Right.
But, yeah, obviously, without question, the market for those little cameras is diminishing drastically. The better and better the cameras get in these things, the less people need those. But then that said, I've been shooting a lot with the smaller cameras. Like, I got a Fuji X100 that's my camera, and then I have a what's it called? Anyway, another small, you know, Micro Four Thirds type camera that I'm carrying around a lot. And I love having the better quality of that camera, but I also love this instant sharing idea.
Sure.
And so what I've actually done is I have one of those iFi cards. Their latest model iFi card, it allows me to send a picture from the camera to my iPhone immediately while I'm out in the field. So I can shoot with a better camera, but then still post those photos to Instagram or whatever I want to do right away. And it's a really nice combination. So it's allowed me to post better quality photos to Instagram that are, you know, something that it's, you know, these aren't award-winning photos. It's not like I'm going out and shooting a professional job. But for those casual everyday shots, I can do something better than what I can get with the iPhone and still post it right away.
Right, right. It's. I mean, there's certainly advantages to the dedicated camera. And so I see what you're saying. At the same time, I'm like, okay, well, we're really into photography. Does most people really care? My inclination on this is to say that I feel like the point and shoot as such, as in terms of buying a separate camera, is largely going away, and time will tell. Barry, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that just watching anecdotally what I see with people around with cameras is, as Joseph said, clearly the phones are what seem to come out of people's pockets and purses to capture most of what's going on.
Right.
And I look at the point-and-shoot cameras and, you know, look no further than the weekly Best Buy ads and things like that, where that category is just shrinking down and down and down. They're just not selling the number of items. They're not promoting it. And I think it's interesting because there's clearly a continued push by Canon and Nikon, not even talking about the mirrorless cameras, but Canon and Nikon keep kind of lowering the bar, the entry-level bar on DSLRs with cheaper and cheaper DSLR cameras with higher and higher megapixels. So it's like they're trying to get people, I think, into relevant cameras because they see the need. I think that's an opportunity they're wisely jumping on. So yeah, I don't see a big reason for the point shoot cameras to have a big place in our lives. I mean, I think they're going to always be around. I mean, I still have that Nikon P7000 that I carry around with me quite a bit because it's better than my iPhone and it's not as nice as my Nikon stuff, but it's tiny and small and I have it with me a lot more of the time.
Right. Right.
And interesting to see.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And admittedly, that P7000 is more towards the enthusiast higher-end camera. Now, when you get into that category, you know, I do see people that are serious photographers saying, oh, I just use my iPhone. I get in debates with them sometimes because I think it's crazy. But in general, I see them targeting the higher-end cameras. They seem to have an increased market now for the higher-end tweener cameras, I guess. I mean, maybe that's not a correct word for them because they are very powerful, but the NEXs, the EOS M, the kind of cameras that are pretty high end, not really point and shoots, but maybe in a point and shoot form factor, but they may cost $1,000 because photography is so popular that the people that are into it, it's like the people that don't really care use their phone. The people that are into it are buying a serious camera, not a point and shoot. That's kind of what I see happening. Brian, what do you think? You see anything interesting in this?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I would agree with you guys in the sense that I definitely see a bit of a parting of the market in terms of more consumers are going towards digital SLRs, the entry level ones, and more are also going towards using their cell phones for their cameras, and I totally see that as a trend going forth. At the same time, being a wedding photographer or you know, when I go on vacations and these kinds of things, when it's something that's important to people, I actually very rarely find that people are, you know, at a wedding with an iPhone taking pictures, and usually they will pull out that point and shoot or that DSLR. So although for everyday stuff, yeah, I totally see people using their iPhones, Instagramming, that kind of stuff. But when it comes time for stuff that's a bit more important, they're on vacation, they're at a reunion party, they're at a wedding, I do still see people using point and shoot cameras.
Interesting. Well, and that's so maybe it hasn't propagated as far as I think. And just to be clear, I am not saying that the iPhone is a replacement in any way for a professional DSLR or anything like that. I know some take that approach, and I absolutely don't. So the people using DSLRs, I put in a different category of maybe they're not professional photographers, but they're into it enough that they want a bigger camera. But you may be right. I mean, I assume because the people that I kind of interact with use their phones for the point and shoots because of the convenience and stuff like that, that everybody does. But, you know, grandma that still has her point and shoot and mom that still has her point and shoot may still be perfectly happy with that and may even go buy another one down the road. So it's pretty interesting.
The thing I see too, like I said, you know, with the price of DSLRs coming down so much, I mean, I just saw an ad the other day for Best Buy. It was just after Boxing Day. It wasn't a Boxing Day sale, but it was like $400 for, you know, the entry-level DSLR with a lens on it and, like, some bag and a card. And it's like, Are you kidding me? If anyone's looking at buying a new camera, why would they even buy a point-and-shoot camera if they can get a DSLR? They think right. they can take the same pictures we take, right, with that camera. So I definitely see more and more people showing up at weddings and showing up at functions and events with DSLRs than I used to, for sure. But I still see the odd point-and-shoot here and there.
Right, right. Yeah,
I think the reality is that more and more people are more interested in how they can take a picture and get it immediately onto Facebook or Instagram or Pinterest or whatever. So devices that make that easy, I think, are going to be what they gravitate to. And if that's their phone, that's their phone. If cameras come along that have some of that capability built in, then I think people will consider it and look at them. But the reality is it kind of comes down to a big part of the problem in the industry professionally is the bar has been lowered so much on quality standards in general. People seem plenty happy with often pretty crappy cell phone pictures, you know, with lame right. little flashes in the cameras. And, you know, they're not getting the great birthday party pictures that they got even from their point and shoot, but it's so darn convenient for
them.
And
all they do is post it to Facebook and right. they don't really care. And admittedly, for the point and shoot image, the snapshot, I guess I should say, I'm not, you know, if I'm making a snapshot, my concern is not quality. I may still use my concepts, of course, of, you know, hey, I want it to be exposed. I don't want it to be too dark. I like the composition. But in reality, if I'm doing a serious photo, a serious camera comes out. There's no way I do a landscape that I'm intending to make prints from with an right. iPhone. So I draw that line simply for the sake of quality. Not that artistically you can't make a good image on a phone. It's just, you know, it's a point and shoot. I mean, even when I was learning, it wasn't the norm to go out in the field with a 110 camera and think that you were going to get a great wall print out of it. But most people, admittedly, when they're making their photos, it's not that big of a deal. It's Billy's birthday right. party and the point and shoot's enough. And as such, I think the phone is enough. And of course, some will differ with me. Some people think, and they certainly have that right that, hey, the iPhone's all I need. I've actually seen people that, you know, said, hey, I'm getting rid of my DSLR. I'm just going to use my iPhone. And I'm just kind of shaking my head like, well, okay.
but then again, you know, look at our friend Larry that bought that Leica X1 or whatever that expensive Leica point and shoot digital camera is, specifically for a Greece trip that he took because he didn't want to haul that time his D3X or whatever system was. And that thing produced phenomenal image quality, and it was small and it fit in his shirt pocket. So it was worth the $2,000 or whatever he spent for it.
Yeah.
Because it fit his application. You obviously played around with that Micro Four Thirds for a while, and I remember at one point you thinking, how cool would this be if I could have a camera to go out and shoot some landscapes that's small and light and easy to carry around? But you quickly found that its technical limitations, you know, from a quality standpoint, just didn't live up to what you knew your standards
needed. It wasn't quite enough. And a lot of it was slow, and it was just more, you know, it wasn't quite right. there. But to be fair,
you also thought that might be a really good travel camera solution until right. you really put it into the field and tested it and said, eh.
Well, and to be fair, yeah, I mean, I agree. The Micro Four Thirds, frankly, and a lot of these compacts, I don't lump in the high-end compacts with these point-and-shoots. It's like the Leica that your friend bought.
Right.
Yes, it has less technical things that you can do with it, but the image quality of that was phenomenal. Maybe it was a bit less resolution, but that was a legitimate camera you could make serious prints from. So when I say a point and shoot, I'm really talking about, you know, a little power
right.
shot, or more commonly somebody's cell phone in terms of serious photos. But the compacts, I mean, we look at things like the EOS M, we look at things like the Micro Four Thirds line, the X100. I mean, there's some compact cameras that are really getting powerful. The NEX7, I mean, I've even thought about going into something like that. It's just they're so expensive. You're actually paying a large premium now for the compacts compared to what you can get a powerful DSLR for.
Right.
Which is interesting. But anyways, I think we're kind of rambling here, but it's fascinating to see. I mean, I guess basically right now we have three categories. We have the point and shoot, which includes phones in my mind, and then we have the compact high-end camera. So I guess we'll call it a semi-pro compact, and then we get into the pro and the semi-pro and the DSLRs. And both of those two upper categories are producing some astounding images considering the form factors and things like that. But I think all of us here pretty much are using DSLRs, or in my case, I'm using film at times as well. But
hey, Gavin, I'm curious, what Micro Four Thirds camera system was it that you were playing with that you decided you didn't like?
I had an EPL-1, and it was far more, actually, I still do have an EPL-1, I just hardly use it. It was more limited, I think it's 12 megapixels, and it was definitely didn't have the noise capabilities and stuff like that. But to be fair, I got the 20mm Pancake now, which I've now sold because it was worth far more than the camera, and I was never using it. it's a phenomenal lens. So it was optically and technically, it could produce great images. I think a lot of the reason I never used it much was not so much the technical limitation, although my DSLR was better and it was, you know, the Micro Four Thirds was still sizable enough that I couldn't truly slip it in my pocket. So it was right. Kind of fell in that range that I never used it a lot. And I think part of that was the intuitiveness of it. It didn't have the snap of a DSLR. I mean, the responsiveness just wasn't there in terms of the focus, in terms of the control, the menus, you know, it wasn't on the same level in terms of how it responded. And
sure.
It was, but I've been watching the compact category for a long time. I don't have a really high-end compact. I think if I was to get one right now, it might be the NEX7, but it's like a $1,200, $1,300 camera, and I'm like, gosh,
right.
You know, I mean, that's a lot of money. You can buy a pretty serious DSLR for that. And so what I find is, actually what I did instead of buying an NEX7 is I just bought a Olympus 35 RC classic 35 millimeter rangefinder, which gives me more resolution, and it cost me about $100. So because I have kind of a love of film these days, that satisfied my craving for something to fit in the glove box. In any case, this is interesting stuff. Do any of you guys actively use any of the current higher end compacts, Micro Four Thirds or anything similar?
Well, yeah, this is what I was trying to remember the name of earlier, is completely spacing on the little Olympus OMD.
Yeah, right. So that's a slightly newer... Oh, that's the larger. That's the SLR version of the Olympus then, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not SLR.
It's not.
Still... No, it's not. It's still mirrorless.
Why does it have a mirror box on top?
It's just the prism where they're... It's not a prism. It's just the box where they're holding the LED or whatever LCD that's inside the viewfinder.
And before you continue, I'm sorry. That was one of my biggest things with a lot of these compacts, and in particular with the EPL1 that they still do on a lot of the Micro Four Thirds, is I really can't stand not having a viewfinder.
Oh, agreed. 100% yeah. Agreed. So that's one of the things I really like about this camera. Now, because it's Micro Four Thirds and the smaller sensor, I wasn't convinced before I got my hands on it.
Right.
And like I said earlier, I've got the Fuji X100, which is a much bigger sensor. That's APS-C. And that's a really nice camera. But I've been working with this for, I guess, maybe a month or so now. I've got it on loan. This is an incredible little camera. It focuses so fast.
Nice.
Even in really low light, it focuses really, really fast. Its low light performance is very respectable. The image quality out of it is, quite frankly, it's great.
Wow.
I mean, it's not, okay, it's not going to replace a Canon DSLR or Nikon DSLR for bigger work. However, for the kind of stuff that you want a smaller camera for, I think it's fantastic. And frankly, I'd go the way of Zach Arias if I could afford it. I would shoot with this and shoot with a medium format digital and get rid of the standard DSLR Canon Nikon entirely.
Now, if I may make another suggestion, you could shoot with that and a Hasselblad medium format film, which if you can count the cost of the medium format camera, you can buy so much film that you're going to be working for years anyhow. And then scan it into aperture and you're good to go.
There you go.
I'm glad to see they're making progress, and that makes sense. It's Micro Four Thirds. What's the resolution on that one?
15, 12 megapixel?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
That's an
it's not super high.
Is that what you said? OM1 or OM?
No, it's OMD is the mod.
That's right.
It's OMD EM5 or some crap like that.
What does that sell for now?
That's a trick question. I don't know. I think it's a little over $1,000 for a kit with the body and a zoom lens, but the zoom lens is kind of eh. There's a lot of really nice primes. This, the one that I have on here now, is a 45 millimeter f1.8, which is a 90 mil equivalent for 35. And this is a great little portrait lens. I think, you know, if you got this with three primes, if you like shooting with primes, which I do, if you got this with three, it's going to fit in a bag about this big, that if you're doing travel photography or, you know, whatever, I mean, just about anything, it's just a fantastic kit to carry with you.
Yeah, and I'm just looking on Amazon, it's actually about $1,299. So it's right up in there with like an NEX7 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My question on these, and we're going to kind of go too long if we keep talking about compacts, but we come back to these every few months, and it's good to look at the different categories of cameras that we're dealing with out there in the market. When I see this, and I've actually heard a few good comments on this camera, people seem to really dig it, and it's very highly reviewed. Why though? I mean, not just do a DSLR. It doesn't seem that much smaller. It's still that form factor.
Oh.
You're not going to slip it in your pocket. So I know it's smaller, but I don't consider it a compact because in terms of compact. So why not just go to a DSLR? It's a lot. You have a... Okay, talk. So your screen comes up. Your voice.
Oh, sorry. Okay, yeah. Right. So yeah. So here, this is.
So there's a lot of difference.
Yeah, there's a big difference there, and in thickness as well.
Right.
And
okay.
Obviously weight.
It's
and
a lot more distinctive side by side.
It's not just the bodies. Yeah. I mean, look at this. Let's see here. So this is my 90. Hold on, I got some gear sitting here. Let me find the lens I'm looking for. Okay. So, all right, this is a bit of a beast of a lens, but here's the Olympus 45mm f1.8. So this is a 90 f1.8. This is the Canon 85 1.2. Okay, it's a little bit bigger, but I mean, just look at the size difference there, right? And the weight difference is, you can't even talk about it, right? So this kit with a couple of lenses is, it'll fit in your hand. You can hold all of it like this and it weighs nothing, and you can easily carry that around all day long and not have a sore back.
Okay.
If I'm carrying even a 5D, you know, forget about a 1D series, but if I'm carrying a 5D type camera and three good lenses, that's a lot of weight, right? That's a lot of weight. And if you're talking about carrying it all day, wherever you're going, a couple extra batteries, you know, it adds up, which is what we're used to, right?
Yeah.
But if you don't need that, and again, the quality is not the same as the DSLR, as the full-on cat. It's not, but it is damn close. And it's good enough for the vast majority of what you would want to use that camera for.
Sure, sure.
Well, that makes sense. Just to throw a little smoke into this, just to make it more interesting too, I actually ran into a Panasonic Lumix rep, and we were chatting a minute about the new mirrorless cameras that, you know, they're all in on right now. And an interesting statement that he made is that their market research, they know that there are so many female photographers entering professional photography, and the number one thing that they complain about is weight of cameras.
Okay. They don't
like, which makes sense. You know, like Joseph, like you just explained, given the choice of two comparable, that can produce, let's just say, comparable results, and one of them is a little bit cheaper and 30 or 40% lighter, I can see where a lot of photographers, certainly a lot of gals, and to some degree a lot of guys are like, well, great, less weight is a good thing to haul around. So, you know, there are a lot of dynamics in this industry that drive these big companies like Canon and Olympus and Nikon. They don't just willy-nilly decide what they're going to do. You know, they've spent millions of dollars researching and trying to decide what it is the consumers really are asking for. And the professional segment's been squeezed pretty significantly in the last several years because the companies have realized that pros just, we're just not that profitable a category compared to the consumers, the prosumer market.
Oh, sure.
And now look at how many photographers that we could each find on Craigslist in the next 30 seconds in our respective markets are soliciting air quote professional work with very, very low end DSLR cameras.
Right. And they, and just kind of jump into it without a lot of experience and go for it, which is really, you know, it's just the reality of the situation. So that's who the camera manufacturers target. What I wonder, this is interesting, and people that have been in this longer and seen the pattern over the years might be able to speak to it more, but correct me if I'm wrong, you know, in the old days, let's go back 20 years, you know, you would go buy a camera, whether it be a Canon or a Hasselblad or whatever. It was not bought under the impression that in 2 years you buy a new camera, was it? I mean, you would be planned to use that camera for the next 20 years, and if you bought something new, it would probably be a new lens or something like that. So on one level, the camera manufacturers had a much smaller market share. You know, they had to really innovate and put things out that would really make people want to buy an upgrade. Now it's like, hey, look, 2 more megapixels, and everybody flocks out and buys a new camera. And admittedly, they are releasing things that are better, but an example of this is look at the new Canon 6D. Make sure I get the number right. It has now GPS, I think it has in it. And it comes out, and here we are in 2012, and I'm like, wait, you're bragging about this? I mean, this thing, you know, my phone has had GPS for how many years now? You know, this camera comes out, they come out with a new flash that's $600 that now has RF communication. I'm like, wait a minute, you're admitting that you've been using like super old technology from our VCRs that went away, you know, 8 years ago that we hardly ever use. I mean, it just seems like the cycle of seeping out features, they just completely take advantage of it. And not that I really blame them. I mean, I guess they are in business if people will buy this stuff that they produce. But isn't that pretty contrasting from how it was, say, 20 years ago, where a camera was an instrument that you would use for decades and then you would buy lenses and things for it? Has that changed a lot?
Well, it's totally changed. But you also, the distinction, though, you have to make is that back in that 20 and 30 year ago time, these kind of working professionals, if you want to use that label, that walked around buying medium format gear, whether it's Hasselblad, Mamiya, 645s, RB, RZ67s, all those medium format type cameras, when you showed up to shoot a wedding with one of those, you garnered some respect from people because it looked like a professional camera. And you're right. The first camera I bought, first Hasselblad I bought, I sold almost 20 years later for $600 more than I paid for it. So it turned out to be a pretty good investment at the time. All I did is build my system. And you're right. There weren't revolutionary new changes coming other than, you know, they would tweak this and tweak that and, you know, and so on. But, but hobbyists at that time weren't throwing money. I mean, I worked in a camera store at that time, and the hobbyists were coming in, and they were buying, you know, they were buying single-lens reflex cameras, you know, like the Rolly 35. There were some kind of eclectic, cool, small, little compact 35s, but they were, for the most part, they were, hey, let me look at that OM-10 or that, what's this Canon AE-1 all about? And, you know, they really wanted to look and feel these cameras. And that's where hobbyists landed. Well, now, of course, as you say, the turnover rate at which people just assume this stuff obsoletes itself.
Which is what the camera manufacturers promote.
Correct. But I've had several cameras that I've wrapped up into 250 or 300,000 clicks on them. And they don't tend to sound too good at 300,000 clicks.
They do wear out eventually. But
they do. And whereas the old gear, you know, both film cameras and, you know, all 35mm SLRs and certainly medium formats. I mean, my Hasselblad ELX, my motorized camera, I still have that thing, and it's just cranking along.
Right. I guess
we're not going to change that.
No, and I realize that. Although what I am wondering is now they've gotten to a point where they've built these massive companies on people constantly buying cameras. And I would arguably say that photography is definitely a fad right now. You know, it's popular to have a cool camera and get this latest thing. The cameras are getting to a point technologically where the reality is you do not need a new camera every year, and they're going to be hard pressed, or every 2 years even, they're going to be hard pressed to hold on in the long term, I think, to this mindset of, oh, they're so much better now, we have to buy a new one, because they're not so much better. You know, we have the 5D Mark III out now. I haven't bought one. It's not so much better than my 5D Mark II in terms of real professional use.
Right.
And yes, it has some features that I'm thinking, okay, that'd be cool to have, but it's not so much better. So I haven't gone down and plunked down $3,000 for this new camera. What I'm wondering is, as this starts to come down, as maybe the fad starts to die off, you know, photography enthusiasts aren't going away. They've been around for 100 years and they've only grown. But I think we will see a downshift as a lot of these people that have ran out and spent 10 grand on new gear realize that it's actually not an easy business to be in. And they may just kind of let it kind of drift and take photos for fun, which will mean they're probably not going to go out and buy new cameras every year. How's that going to affect? We can't predict
but
this,
Gavin,
of course, but is that going to be a hard hit? You know, it's, our company's going to go bankrupt because they can no longer sustain the same.
No, because I think you just answered the question. It's such a turnstile of people entering professional photography, air quotes, that I think that for every couple of them that bought equipment a couple of years ago have realized that, wow, this is a tough business and I don't really think I want to do this anymore. I think they're replaced by five or six more behind every one of them that quit.
But that will fade.
Who are running into, well, it grows every minute, that, you know, they're happy to go in and buy whatever gear, you know, the gear of the month is. But having said that, you know, I mean, we all handle a lot of cameras and, you know, a few weeks ago on an emergency basis, I got called from a friend of mine that I've known for a long, long time. He actually shot my wedding way back when, to tag along as a second shooter for him because his guy got sick or whatever. And he requested that I shoot with his Canon 30Ds that he has his second shooter use.
Right.
Well, I haven't been a Canon guy for a long, long time, but I can handle any camera, so it doesn't really matter to me. But I just found myself eye rolling how horrible the performance on that Canon 30D was. Just how I've gotten so used to newer, better cameras, I was just like, oh, this is a piece of junk. It's not a piece of junk. It worked fine for what I did.
Right,
the images turned out great, but I have gotten used to a new standard. So as they raise the bar, we all get used to gear that's a whole lot more fun to shoot. Bigger viewfinders, things just are better. There's better information. They have better performance.
But the 30D was in an era when things were changing fast. I mean, I remember when the 5D came out, that was like a shifting point where things were really ramping up. And we're not, you know, it's come back to the 5D Mark II to Mark III. The difference is not as sharp as we saw back then. But I mean, these are all good points. I think still it's going to go way down. I don't think this flux of everybody buying and, you know, 10 more coming in for every one that goes out in a market, it won't last because it's getting to where it's not so cool to be a photographer anymore. You know, you say, look, I'm a photographer, and they're like, yeah, okay, whatever. So, I mean,
everybody else is too.
There's no question that, you know, I mean, it's not the coolest thing in the world now to have an orange fondue pot on your kitchen, to have an orange blender, to wear fishnet stockings. I mean, things do come and go. And photography, while photography's not going away, I think there's no question that it's a fad over the past couple years, and it's still in to be a photographer. But when everybody's doing it, it's just the nature of fads, in my experience, that it's kind of no longer cool. But we'll see what happens.
Well, I hope you're right.
In any case, we're rambling on. One quick more news story I want to talk about that's not a brand new news story, but an interesting one to bring up that's kind of fun, is the Adobe CS2 issue. And I don't know if you guys saw this or not. I'm sure you did. But what happened is Adobe shut down the licensing servers for Adobe CS2, the entire creative suite. And then they released the downloads on their site. I'm actually going to link this so you can check it out. And this is interesting because what they did is they put all the downloads for Windows, Mac, the whole creative suite, along with serial numbers that work for it. And you can just download it and activate it. And so sites picked this up because they just posted it. They said, hey, here's CS2 downloads. We're deactivating the servers. Here's the downloads and all the serial numbers. CNET, all these big places picked it up. So they were just, I can't imagine the bandwidth that they went through in that couple of days. And people were on forums saying, well, no, this is only for people that own it. That's all it's posted for. And there's actually a note on the Adobe page now that says, you know, this is meant for people, for customers that purchase CS2 and who legitimately own it, etc. But they haven't locked it down in any way. So it's still all these downloads. And initially that wasn't even there. It was just conjecture on the forums and things like that. So I can imagine that they had millions and millions of downloads of this. And frankly, I really don't think this will hurt their business. I mean, if anything, I think they should say, hey, here it is. It's free. Download it. Because a lot of these people would get in there and then say, wow, I want to upgrade to the newest version. So it's just interesting. It was kind of surprising that they did that. And I just went to the link again, and I was actually kind of surprised that they have actually not taken it down. So, well, I don't know. Did any of you guys notice this and see the little fiasco that went down with that? Or
I didn't see it, but I actually think it's a little bit of a smart play on their part. You know, something that's similar, CameraBits just did something very similar. CameraBits makes Photo Mechanic, which is a software I'm sure a lot of you guys are familiar with.
Yeah.
They're coming out with the new Photo Mechanic there in a little bit, and they released the old one just for free for people to check out and download the serial number and all that for.
Yeah, it's a smart
so
thing to
you
do.
Know same idea. So
yeah, awesome. And then
you get promised new features. I mean, why not, right?
Well, and to be fair, I don't think that's why Adobe released it, even though that would have been smart of them. But I think they weren't intending it to go viral like it did, but it did. And probably they haven't taken it down because it would just make them look bad at this point. And it really, I don't think, is going to hurt them. But it's fascinating. I don't know how CS2, on some of the machines, you're even going to have a problem running CS2 because it's on a Mac. On the Mac, it's meant for the PowerPC series. So I don't even know if it'll run. If it will, it's probably going to be very slow. Okay. Any other interesting things anybody wants to bring up before we move on into some lightning rounds and main topics? Our news kind of went into random ramblings, which we often do, but is there anything else anybody wants to shout out before we continue? And there are the crickets. And let me just see here if I can pop up my cricket sound, and well, that's a squeaky toy. That's close enough. All right, let's move on into some more interesting things for this show, and I'm just gonna pop open into here. First of all, our topic of the month that I kind of had down for this show was just coming into 2013, kind of some pro tips, some quick hits, just ideas, things we're thinking about. Every year at the beginning of the year, we tend to have this episode, and oftentimes it turns into a rant of, oh, look at the state of the industry. I really do want to try and stay positive. It's a tough industry to be in. We are not in an easy industry, as all of those of us that are out there doing portraits or pictorials or whatever it is we're doing, we know how hard it can be out there right now. But from a practical perspective, for those of us that are here, that are working hard and trying to make things happen, let's just chat a little bit about what we're doing and what we're going to try and do going forward. What's our long-term plans, and how are we hoping to make photography work for us going forward in a market and in an economy that is a bit admittedly challenging for a lot of photographers. So who wants to go first? We'll just kind of go through, you know, just one 60-second, two-minute kind of stints of each person sharing a few ideas, and we'll just go through a few of those and go around once or twice and just share a couple of concepts, and then we'll move on to something else. So, Barry, do you want to go?
Well, the big thing, like I say, right now my big priority is trying to get my wedding business back to some kind of a level that it should be at. I've shot weddings for a long time. I'm just way too good at shooting weddings to not be shooting a lot more than I am. The price point has been really driven down to a very low level in this market. Sure. There are still photographers who on occasion are able to book decent paying weddings. It's just coming a lot tougher. I think I sent you my little PDF of sort of a magazine style brochure that I put together. That's a impressive piece. I'm meeting tomorrow morning with a bride and her mom. It's my first prospect response that actually turned into a, hey, we want to come and meet you. Nice. And it was interesting, the feedback I got. You know, it was a contact, an email contact through a referral from a friend. And I emailed her right away, said, love to chat, take a look at this. This has got a lot of comprehensive information, blah, blah, blah. She called me within 5 minutes and just was like, oh my gosh, I've been talking to photographers for 2 weeks. I haven't seen anything like this. You just blew everybody out of the water. When can we possibly meet you?
Nice.
Well, that's pretty
encouraging. That's a rare thing to hear these days.
Tell me about it. I mean, I'm gonna be the guy crying in the lobby when she walks in tomorrow morning. I'm going to be so excited. I'll probably hug her and her mom, and, you know, so I just have to hold my emotions back. But it is very encouraging to hear that. Now, we'll see how the conversation goes and whether – but the nice thing is I've sort of laid out some parameters of what I do. I've given a lot of image examples, a lot of tips, a lot of things that are there. And so I'm encouraged by that. I'm going to do a wedding show in mid-February in my market. Which they've been begging me to come back to, and that's fine. And so
you're just trying to take, you know, we are where we are, and you're just trying to ramp it up and find ways that you can show people the value in a product that's higher end. Now, can I clarify real quick? Because you mentioned this magazine, and I saw this; it was really well done. For the people that haven't seen it, basically what you did is you made a brochure, but it wasn't a brochure so much as, gosh, what was it? 6 or 7 pages. You showed your images and you talked about, yes, you know, it was a promotion for your company, but at the same time you talked about tips, things to look for, how to handle things with photography, how to try and organize your day better. And you made it a little bit of a toolkit as well as an advertisement and showcase your work throughout.
Correct. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, a couple of photographer friends of mine that I showed it to, you know, were all worried that, oh boy, I think you put too much information. Boy, the newbie could get a hold of that. And you've given him too much of a roadmap of
you
know, post, you know, it, right. But you know what? That's okay. Because if I get brides that view that as a valuable tool, I'm not shy about putting myself out there with that. And there wasn't a better way, at least in my mind, to sort of underscore the fact that, you know, like the tagline I used, you know, 1,000 brides can't be wrong. I've shot over 1,000 weddings.
Right.
And I'm still really good at it, and I still love doing it. And so if the quality of your work, and if I can show enough of the hip, fun stuff that all the kids think they want to see, and then brand it in such a way where I just look like I'm the guy, maybe it'll help turn my wedding
category. Adding value. That's what it's all about.
I'm trying something anyway.
You got it. That's the thing to do. Brian, what about you? You know, I don't know how business is going out in your neck of the woods or what challenges you're facing, but what are you doing and what do you see in 2013?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the sentiments there that you share, Barry, I'm seeing a lot around here with some of the photographers. And for me, things are going great for me. You know, weddings for 2013 are looking up. One of the things that I always like to talk to photographers about, you know, I mentioned earlier that I wrote a book called Pricing for Profit about pricing for photographers. And I do a lot of teaching and talking on that to other photographers. And this is the time of the year, you know, January, February, March. For most photographers that are doing, you know, the weddings and portraits where things slow down, it's kind of cold outside, at least up here. We have snow, whatever. People, you know, don't want to be out there doing portraits. So things get slow, bank accounts start to get low if you haven't planned properly for it. Right. And this is the time of the year where some photographers start to actually get scared, especially up here because of the weather. And they say, oh my gosh, you know, things aren't looking good. what's going on? Where's my money? It's all gone. I had to pay taxes in April, you know?
Exactly.
And it's a tough time of the year. And a lot of the times photographers start to fret and they start to say, oh, you know, I need to start giving discounts. I need to start lowering prices. I need to start doing all these deals. And then you end up putting yourself in this vulnerable state where you're just being completely reactive and you're not actually doing yourself any good at the end of the day. So the first thing that I always encourage photographers this time of the year is, as tight as things might look, now isn't the time to be trying to offer discounts or give something value like that to get more money now. Like, you had to do that stuff 5 months ago if you wanted to get more business now.
Right, right.
So for sure, I mean, this is a tough time of the year. I totally hear those concerns with photographers, but hang in there. And you need to take this time off and take this slow time to plan for the rest of 2013, plan the end of your year this year so it doesn't happen again in 2014. And you can prevent that and learn from your mistakes.
And
don't be organized and don't be reactive to how things are right now. Because if you put yourself in that place, you're going to give off the wrong image to your clients. You're going to look desperate. It's just not going to give off the right image. So you just have to be really careful with that stuff.
Good stuff, Brian. Hey, I want to shout out to my kids at home and say hi to them. I know at least my one-year-old is watching, and he's excited to be watching the live show. So hello to the kids. Joseph, what do you got for us?
Well, actually, I just want to, Brian, you were talking about, you know, now's not the time to discount. Would you even suggest that now is maybe a time to raise your rates just to...
Totally.
Yeah, because if you're not getting that many calls in right now, nobody's going to notice that, oh, look, your rates just went up from yesterday. It's no, this is my new rates for 2013. And if anybody does ask, I mean, it's, I never understood this discount idea. If, eventually we all have to raise our rates, that's just life. That's the way it is. And obviously you're getting better, hopefully, as a photographer. So you're offering a better value for the service, and, you know, you charge more. Why not? That just seems fair to me.
For sure.
So for me locally, what I've been doing is, I haven't been doing a whole lot of photography over the last several years, last couple of years. I got really onto the Aperture Expert site and just put a lot of effort into that and doing a lot of training. And I had a handful of bigger corporate, bigger travel jobs that were great, and those kind of filled in for the year. But a lot of those have dried up as well. And so what I've been doing over the last several months is I've decided to really focus on local. And I live in a pretty small town, so it's easy for me to do networking here. And I've joined the local Chamber of Commerce, and I've joined a professional networking group. And through this, I am getting introduced to all kinds of small business owners who need my services. Now, I can't charge the same that I would charge in LA or New York or something, but I can certainly charge a fair amount. It's local, so it's quick and easy to do, no travel involved. And it's a great way to keep on working, keep the money coming in, and being a small town, it shouldn't take a whole lot of effort to really become, you know, one of the, if not the most recognized photographers in the city. And that's kind of what I'm aiming to do right now with my photography, is just focusing on local. And I want to become the guy that everybody knows, if you need photos in this town, this is where you go.
Right. So again, I guess we're all coming back to adding value to the product that we want to produce, taking slightly different approaches, but ultimately we need our name out there. And more importantly than the quantity, you know, the extent of how far our name reaches is, I think, the quality that is associated with our name and the value we can project on that. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
So, Gavin, what are you doing?
Well, it's all very interesting. I have been focusing the past year or two a lot on technique. I've been doing a lot of educational stuff. Of course, I did the exposed workshop that we released this last year, which was a huge project. I've got another film I'm working on this year called Photographics, and that's going to be kind of on some of the more ambiguous things in terms of composition and line and things like that, looking at the same time at photo history and stuff. So I've been doing a lot of projects on the side of the photography world, largely, well, for two reasons. One, photography has been tougher, but also because that stuff has been ramping up over the past few years, it's allowed me, probably a lot like you, Joseph, to kind of analyze what I'm doing with my photographic work and what I want to do. So I've been working on building my pictorials line, And we've talked about this before. I don't have any magic bullets for anybody yet. I've not found a way to make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year selling fine art prints, but I'm consistently working on that in terms of building portfolios, trying to figure out how can I build a brand for my landscape and pictorial work and my travels and stuff that I show over at f164.com. Real quick side note, I'm actually hitting the road in about a week for 3 months, so you can follow us over there and on Twitter at Gavin Syme and things like that and kind of see what I do throughout that process. But on the one side then, in answer to the question, I am building the brand of my pictorials, but that's not going to be a quick turnaround. I'm about 4 or 5 years in to basically like a 10-year plan to try and make those profitable and build a brand to the point where people will buy my fine artwork for the value that I can put on it. Not just, oh, it's a nice photo, because that's not enough to sell fine artwork. What I've learned in going to a lot of different galleries and photographers and seeing who's doing well, and in the fine art market, there's not a lot of people that are in terms of a profitability standpoint. It's definitely about the brand, and people need to buy my work because it's a Gavin Syme limited edition, not just because it's a pretty photo, because there's zillions of pretty photos out there. I mean, everywhere you go, you know, whether you walk into Walmart or Costco or Lowe's or Home Depot, you know, if they just want a pretty photo, they're everywhere. You know, you can get a $29 gallery wrap. On the portrait and wedding side, I haven't given up on that. I did not very much with portraits, and I did no weddings in 2012. And I'm not ashamed of the fact that I did no weddings. It was really nice to kind of have a year off from weddings. Basically, I'm kind of in that place, experiencing a lot of the stuff that many photographers are. People aren't wanting to spend for weddings, and I'm not willing to give them away. And it's interesting because on the one hand, I totally relate to, okay, we need to raise prices and this and that. On the other hand, we are in a down economy and things are tough. I don't know if now's the time to be raising prices unless you're actively getting jobs, because I just see people not valuing the quality photograph. Even if they see your work and it's quality, oftentimes I'm seeing consumers, particularly in the wedding market, that just don't know the difference. So I really like, you know, where Barry's going in terms of trying to find ways to add value. And I've not said, oh, I'm bowing out of the wedding market. I'm just kind of watching and seeing what's happening and seeing where this goes. On the other hand, I'm wanting to build up more into the family portrait market, in particular portraits in general of individuals, but family portraits and doing my large wall portraits. The biggest one I did in 2012 was a very large family, and we did a 55-inch canvas for them. That's the kind of thing I really want to focus on in terms of my portrait work. And to me, it's so much in line with what I do in my pictorials, because I take families out and I put them in these beautiful scenes that are relevant to them. And a lot of the stuff that I've talked about for years that I learned at Wall Portrait Conference, which is where you go if you really want to master making and selling the wall portrait. And it's amazing. In fact, this year's Wall Portrait Conference is scheduled already, and it's coming up in March, I believe it is, mid-March, somewhere in there. I don't know the exact dates, but I'll put it in the show notes as well. Regardless, what I'm trying to do is I'm continuing on my products and education for photographers. We just released Color Fantasies, the Lightroom presets, all that kind of stuff. While I have that, I'm also working on building the pictorial work and also trying to build the portraits and things like that. I'm going to look seriously at doing a fair booth, a county fair booth, which may sound kind of goofy. And I wouldn't do something like this for weddings, but you have a lot of families and things. And if you go, Kim Whitmire in particular takes this beautiful booth where he's taking his large canvas work of families and things. And it really does stand out. You don't see a lot of photographers at your fairs. You know, they tend to go to the wedding shows and there's tons of them there, but at fairs and things like that, you don't see that. And when you have a significant display of like family portraits and stuff, I think there's potential there. I think there's a lot of potential in the family. It's been largely getting ignored because the people that jump into the market are saying, oh, I need to do senior portraits and weddings. That's where the money is. Ask yourself, is that where the money is? Is that what you should be focusing on? What do you want to focus on? And what's being tapped in your area? The family portrait is woefully ignored. It's amazing how few people have a quality portrait of their family. So I'm looking strongly at that this year. And I went longer than I should have. So does anybody else have any kind of closing thoughts to all this? I think we've covered some neat things in terms of what we're all doing. But anything out there?
Yeah, I guess let me just sort of continue on that conversation. You know, it's kind of a shame that we've gotten to the point where we've got all these amazing professional photographers that have been in business for a long time that are sort of, to a certain extent, having to throw in the towel with things and having to bring their prices down to stay competitive. I mean, they create incredible photographs. They're incredibly reputable. I mean, I can name a number of photographers who, you know, 15 years ago, they were the only photographer in town, like in Niagara.
Right.
And now they're like, you know, sitting here closing up shop, but they're having to, you know, slash prices, you know, into like 10% of what they should be charging. Right. And it's a shame. And I think one of the things that we really need to continue focusing on, at least one of the things that I've seen in successful photographers that are charging good dollar these days for wedding photography and for portrait photography, is to make it more than just about the photography. Now, I know that totally sucks to say that on a photography related podcast, but you know, basically looking at it from the back end too, in terms of people want to hire someone that they can like, people want to hire someone that they can trust, that they can get along with, that they can build a relationship with, and they want to have an experience that's going to be more than just walking into a studio, taking a picture and walking out. Because if that's all you're getting and that's all you're giving, you can't charge a premium dollar for that. So if we can turn it around, I know it's, you know, it's kind of always been about this really, but now I find more often than not, instead of a photographer trying to increase the experience they can give their clients, or you know, take better pictures or become more likable or more relatable to their clients, they just slash prices, or they kind of continue on this point where they say, oh, well, I've earned my right and I've been doing this for you know, whatever, and you should be paying me. And then, you know, there's one photographer here who his ego got so much in the way that he actually quit photography altogether and started working for a local camera store because he just couldn't, he wouldn't take the energy or the time to try and adapt with things.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. And that's just sort of my sentiment or my thought is that instead of getting discouraged by it, because I know it sucks, I can totally relate. I know I have a lot of friends in the industry that are like that. Let's flip it on its head and let's try and give more back to clients. Don't slash prices. Let's, you know, give more back and see what we can to make the experience better for them.
My response to that, and not that I disagree, because I think the experience and the service, I mean, I was just ranting about this on my Facebook page last night about how low the levels, not necessarily in photography, but just in businesses in general, how low service has gotten, especially large businesses. And I'm somebody who gets really ticked off if I'm giving bad service. You know, like, I'm paying you, I want quality and I want service. Regardless of that, The only issue I take with this is that the whole experience, quote, has been being preached from, you know, the people on the workshop circuits for years now. And
totally.
To the point where it's almost become a fad of, oh, it's all about the experience, to the point where we have photographers in the market that really have no idea how to make quality photos for people, but those people hire them because they play up the emotional and all the experience so much. So while, yes, the experience I think is really important, the problem is, can you really stand out with that at this point? Because that's what everybody that just bought a camera last week and has no idea what they're doing. Well, what they do know how to do is try and be nice to the person and build a relationship game, even though they may have no clue. So I'm not knocking the idea of building the experience, but how do photographers, and I don't think they should be slashing their prices to any significant degree. I mean, if you're not making money, if you're working for free, there's no point. You know, you're not really in business. It's kind of pointless. But you have all these photographers out there that are trying to get into this market too. Some of them are great. Some of them are not. Many of them may not be great photographers, but they make an experience and they're selling themselves. So the reality is you still have to combat that. I mean, to be a little bit of the realist here, you still have these people working for next to nothing, playing the experience game, and you still have to give people a reason why they want to hire you over the next guy, because they're going to look at you and say, well, the other guy's promising me this great, incredible experience too, and his photos seem fine to me. I don't really care. They're just as good as everything else I see on Facebook, and he's super cheap. He'll work for $500. He'll work for $1,000. It's interesting. I mean, this is a challenge, and I know we have a lot of listeners that are newer photographers getting into the market, and sometimes people get, you know, annoyed with my straightforward approach, but I don't begrudge anyone trying to get into photography, but the reality is it is very hard right now, and we have to look at all the aspects of how we can raise the bar, not only in service and in the experience, but in our work, and try and, you know, kind of look. I feel like to be a photographer, you need to look 5 years into the future right now, and that's kind of where you need to be shooting and seeing where is this curve going. So I'm just kind of tacking on to all this. Joseph, do you have any thoughts on this before we wrap it up?
No, I think I said what I had to say.
Barry, anything else?
Nope.
Okay. Brian, you good?
No, I'm good.
I think the problem is there's not an easy answer here, and it would be nice to say here's what we need to do and press ABC and we're going to be super successful. It's just not that straightforward. So let's keep working at it. Let's try and stay positive. Let's raise the bar in 2013 in all areas. I mean, we need to consider how we can market and sell and how we can give a great experience for our clients, do all this stuff, and try to keep it going up in quality and profitability. Okay. With that, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come into some lightning rounds before we wrap up into picks this week. And real quick, before we do that, this show is brought to you by SimFX this week and SimFX Photo Tools, and in particular, the brand new Color Fantasies 2 for Lightroom. Color Fantasies is color alchemy for Lightroom. It's going to do some really subtle and amazing things. I think you're going to like what you see. Head over to simeffects.com/color, simeffects.com/color. Just watch the video over there. Check out the live demo at simeffects.com. You can actually try every preset on an image and go through and kind of see what they do. What's neat about Color Fantasies is a lot of us have been using Lightroom for quite a few years now. You know, it's a powerful toolkit and we're comfortable. We don't feel like necessarily, okay, I need this tool over here. You know what to do in Lightroom. Color Fantasies, the goal of it is, yes, to give some of those bold creative color effects that we like to use occasionally, but there's a lot of really subtle stuff, some film-inspired stuff, some cinema-inspired stuff, and sometimes it's just this gentle touch of color that's kind of inspired by the days when you would buy this film over here to get this shift in the color and this film over here to get that shift in the color. And it's a powerful system that's not meant to take the control away from you. It puts you right in control. You can apply these effects and see a lot of variables on an image that you wouldn't get otherwise. And then if you want to, you can tweak it and mix it and match it because you're all within that Lightroom environment. So simeffects.com. And of course, there's lots of other tools over there as well. Everything over there for Lightroom is Lightroom 4 compatible. There's the actions. There's Lightflow for aperture. Lots of tools there that I think you'll enjoy checking out. And of course, the educational stuff like the exposed workshop, and HDR magic, cloning magic, that kind of stuff. SimFX.com keeps us going around here. Head over there and check it out. And with that, let's move on into some lightning rounds and wrap this up before it gets too late. So, Brian, you mentioned copyright earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And let's do a quick lightning round. I mean, probably we just really need a minute for each of us, but let's just go around and do kind of our traditional lightning round and just take 60 seconds to kind of, maybe 90 seconds, okay, to tell people what we do with copyright, if anything. It'll be good with you on here, Brian, because you can kind of give a different input. What city are you in again?
Niagara Falls, I guess we'll call it for lack of a better term.
Okay. And let's talk about it a little bit. So who wants, I will go first, what the heck, and just give a quick rundown on copyright. And of course, this is United States. So I'm not as proactive about copyright as I should be, but what I do is I'm not fanatical about it. I go in, I'm supposed to go in every year. This doesn't always happen. And I go through my important images and I register them with the copyright office. It's not that hard. You can do it online, but you do have to fill out the paperwork and things like that. I use the ECO, I think they call it, the electronic copyright something. I'm not sure what the acronym stands for, but you can go online, you can fill out the form, and oftentimes I'm registering published images, which is a slightly larger hassle because they've already been on my blogs and promoted as prints and things like that. I don't go in every month and register, and some people will chastise me for that. Perhaps I should be, but to be honest, I don't get super paranoid about it because I feel like, okay, if somebody wants to steal my images, you know, and make prints, they're going to do it. And if somebody were to really steal my image and use it for profit, at least in the United States, not having the copyright registered does not mean you don't own the copyright. You absolutely do. Now, the way it works is if, let's say you had a lawsuit that came up and somebody used your image, first of all, the first thing you want to do is make sure that particular image has been registered. You do have the ability to register that image. And I think there's actually a grace period in terms of how it's all looked at when it comes to damages and things like that, if it comes down to a court case, if the image has been registered or not. You still own the copyright regardless, but certainly you want that registered. You definitely don't want to go into a courtroom and not have your images registered if it were to come to that. So anybody else can input here and kind of correct me if I'm wrong. I have spent a good deal of time looking into copyright stuff. I don't get fanatical about it, but I go through and I take the images that are out there and that are important to me and that may be used for prints or somebody. I think, okay, they might take this and use it in an ad, that kind of thing. And I send the disc in or upload them depending on what the situation is in terms of the rules for the batch of image you're doing, and send it in, get it registered, and just have it done. I don't do every wedding in portrait session because, frankly, I've never had a real issue with it. And if an image was stolen, of course, I would say, okay, let's get that in there, make sure it's registered so we can deal with this if it was stolen in a serious sense. But on the other hand, the workflow issue of going for every image I take for every portrait, every wedding, sending in a separate thing, there's a significant cost to it. I think it's about $30. So it's not a big deal if you're doing a huge batch at once. But if you do that constantly, it would add up. So that's just kind of the approach I take. Let's continue around and kind of see what other people do, if anything, in terms of copyright. Joseph, what do you got going with copyright and how do you handle it?
So I'll copyright a batch of images at a time. Usually, well, when I do a job, those images go straight to copyright before they get handed off to the client or anything else.
Right? So you're pretty proactive about it.
Yeah, absolutely. That'll happen right away. And because, like you said, you can batch copyright, you can copyright a bunch of them. I have a little process I go through. I basically create a high resolution contact sheet out of Aperture, right, and just print out a big PDF and I upload that. And so I'll do, you know, hundreds or thousands of photos at a time, just depending on what it is. If I've got a bunch of jobs back to back, then I might do all those at once, register them all at once. It doesn't really matter, as long as I can get them. Mainly my important thing there is to get them to the copyright office before they get put out, given to the client or go online or anything like that. As far as my more casual stuff, what I'll do is when I have a job that I'm going to copyright, I will take that opportunity to also grab the last month or whatever of copyrighted images that I do want to throw in there, and I'll just add those in as well. Kind of, you know, I'm already paying for this for the professional jobs. I'll just go ahead and throw my personal stuff in there at the same time as well. So that's basically the approach that I take. So I'll go through quite a number of times a year and submit the batches of images to the office. And that's pretty much it. It's pretty straightforward. It doesn't take all that long. Yeah, it's a pain in the butt.
It's not terrible.
I wish that it was easier. You know, I wish that it was
better. It'd be nice if there was a widget in Aperture or Lightroom or something and it just said
Register. Yeah, you know what's interesting is that the Copyright Office doesn't have an API, right? And that's the problem. That's why the only way to do it is to go to the Copyright Office website. If they created an API, it would be so much easier.
And all kinds of stuff.
You could have plugins. You could have an iPhone app, right? I mean, why shouldn't I be able to, even for 99 cents a copyright, even if you did it individually, to be able to, from an iPhone app, say, submit this picture to the Copyright Office. All my information is already pre-populated in there. Submit, done, great. Now, before I post that image to Twitter, I don't have to worry about it. If it's an image that I think is good enough that it's worth doing that to, I don't need to worry about it.
Sure.
But we can't because they don't have an API.
It's a hassle. I mean, it's a hassle relative. It's not a huge deal. But that's my problem, is just that there's a lot of steps. And frankly, I've had people steal content before, but it's never been an issue where I ended up in court with somebody. You know, I've had PPA intervene a little bit, send letters and things like that. And I've had to deal with people on this. But I've never had a serious issue. And I know that I own my copyright regardless, even though I am not being quite as proactive, perhaps, as I should be. So with that, Brian, what do you do with copyright? Anything?
Yeah, you know, I kind of feel like I'm slumming it over here a little bit. I mean, I'm a wedding and portrait photographer, and that's 99.9% of the work that I produce is wedding and portrait work. And as such, every one of my wedding and portrait clients do sign a contract, giving me the right to the copyrights, even though now it is assumed that I have it as of November. Regardless, I still do have the contract, and that is all signed and all taken care of. So, I do own the copyright. And to be honest, I've been through the small claims court process. I had to sue a contractor that I had hired a few years ago. It is not a fun process. I don't know if you guys have ever been through that before, but oh my gosh, like I will go to any extent to avoid going through that, you know?
It's certainly something to avoid. Yeah, we live in very litigious societies, but the last thing I want to do is end up in court. But what you're saying is that you really, at this point, do not register your copyrights.
I do not register them, no. But, you know, for me, I'm dealing with... You just totally asked that leading question to get that reaction.
To get the sound effect in there. I totally hear you. And to be honest, I mean, I know that, you know, you say, well, you didn't register your copyrights, and there's going to be somebody that says, well, that's just stupid and crazy. The reality is, I think a lot of photographers don't register their copyrights, and I kind of understand why. It's kind of a pain. I think it's a good thing to do, and that's why I'm not fanatical. I feel like, okay, I go in occasionally, and I lump the stuff together that I feel is important to be registered, and I register it. But I don't have a rigid workflow like I do on something like backup, because my main concern is, you know, that I have images. I'm very, very rigid about my backup. I think that is critical. I think a copyright workflow is certainly something that should be considered, but you got to determine, how do you want to handle it? What do you want to do with it? Barry, what are you doing?
Absolutely nothing.
So you've been in this business, you know, what is it, like 80? No, sorry, it's not 80 years. Like 30 years now. I don't know. I don't know how many years. Yep. But
same as Brian. I mean, I'm a wedding portrait guy, and I've just never bothered to register copyrights.
Right.
You know, I haven't done a lot of work outside those genres. The little bit I do here and there, I just have never taken the time to do it or pursue it, and nor have I ever had to be in court over it. So.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, you look at those that do a lot of weddings and portraits and things like that. Copyright is not terribly expensive, but if you had a huge volume going through, you know, let's say you registered every week, I mean, that adds up. If you register every job separately immediately, you could be spending tens of thousands of dollars a year. Admittedly, somebody like you, Barry, you could say, hey, we're going to register once a month. It wouldn't be that expensive, but you still got to go into every one of those jobs, export contact sheets or reference files of all those images, fill out the forms. It would be a very sizable overhead, I think, for a higher volume studio like you. And I think that in something,
I just don't see any real potential return on it. So,
well, it's not like your clients are buying those images and plans to go sell them on iStock.
Right.
So, and I tend to be more concerned about registering my fine artwork. I'll register the important portraits, the ones that I've put out there, wrote articles about, and that I've, you know, the kind of things that somebody might steal off my website. And I'll register my fine artwork, things like that, the kind of stuff that somebody, what if somebody takes and goes and they're making mugs or prints or something out of this. But I don't get paranoid about it. Does anybody have any other thoughts on this? Does anybody think the other party in this panel is crazy or anything like that? Okay, there's silence. They're all like, well, we all know who's crazy in this panel. Okay, Brian, since you're in Canada, real quick, since you haven't registered your copyrights, you can't really give us a lot of insight. When you're on next time and maybe you've registered some copyrights, maybe you can let us know. Do you know legally, I mean, in terms of, you said it's just changed now. Basically, then it's the same as us now. If you don't register, you still own the copyright then by default.
Yes.
But if you were to go be in court with it, it needs to be registered kind of thing. Is that kind of where you're at as well?
Honestly, I don't know exactly how
never
that works.
Had to deal
and,
with it.
And call me naive, but that's where I'm not, as my understanding goes, you know, if I take the picture, I import it into my computer, it assigns automatically the IPTC data, all that kind of stuff. It's got my copyright information right in there. If anything ever happened, I would think that would be enough.
That's again, something to look into. I mean,
I hesitate to
put that out to the world,
yeah,
because there's, you know, we have a lot of listeners in Canada, of course. So this is something we'll have to come back to. I mean, never thought about, I never think about Canada. No, just kidding. I've never considered how the Canadians have to deal with the copyright. And basically, I mean, in line with what you're saying, in the United States, yes, you don't even have to put a symbol on it. I mean, you own the copyright because you took the photo. Some people assume that, oh, it was online and not marked, so it's fair game. No, that's not how it works. Whoever made that image absolutely owns the copyright. But in terms of a legal sense, if you were to have to appear in court or something and you had some kind of case that came up, then at least in the United States, I believe it has to be registered before you were to appear before a judge on it. And you can register after the fact, but there could be some consequences in terms of how long you wait to register after the fact and things like that. So I don't want to shout out specific information when I don't have the documents in front of me. I've looked into it before, but something like the legal handbook for photographers or something like that is certainly a good investment to review from various facets. And I think if you were doing highly active in commercial or something like that, or stock, this could be more important to have a consistent workflow for those of us, you know, like you, Brian, and like you, Barry, and things like that, that are consistently doing weddings, portraits. I honestly don't think it's a big issue, but I think it would be prudent for all of us to at least have a regime where once a year we take those images that are really our top-notch stuff, the kind of stuff that somebody might want to steal and use on their website or use in an ad, because this certainly happens every day, and send those registrations in.
Yeah, I can't comment on the timing of when you can or can't or whatever when before you go to court, but whoa, what that noise was. But what I do know is that if you have copyrighted the image ahead of time and you find that it's been, you know, misappropriated, if you send a letter or whatever to them saying, look, this is what I'm demanding, this is what you need to pay because here is clearly copyrighted, you didn't license the image from me, there's no way it's going to go to court because you can't disprove it. It's just fact. It's, look, you stole the image. Here it is in your newspaper. Here's the copyright. Very clearly, this is a copyrighted image. You cannot win. So at that point, the odds of you going to court are virtually nil. There's no way that they're going to take you to court because there's no way they can win.
I don't know, to be honest, I think a lot of them, depending on how much they thought they could win, would take you to court on it. Because the reality is what you just said applies even if you haven't registered your copyright. You own that copyright. It is a blatant infringement if they use it without your permission.
Right, but it's harder to prove.
It's not harder to prove because the law exists. You say, this is the law. I took the image. That's the end of story. So from I'm not disagreeing so much as saying from what you just said, the same thing applies. I mean, it's still just as non-winnable of a case because you own that image. I mean, you can go back to the file, say, here it is, you know? And now you may have a very relevant point. Admittedly, I've not been in court over this. I've had interactions with people on it and, you know, people telling me, well, no, our webmaster told us that it was on the internet so we could take it. And then ultimately they ended up paying. It wasn't like some ridiculous amount, but I made them pay a use fee for it. And it's an interesting topic. I think that it bears personal looking into for each individual situation. All I'm saying, Joseph, is that sometimes, regardless of the law, I mean, people know that images are copyrighted. I know that I can't just go take whatever image, and I think a lot of people, if even though they may pretend not to know, they know that too. So if they're doing that, the question is, are they really just going to hand you over a check, or are they going to say, fine, see you in court and call your bluff and see if you will take on that risk? I don't know. I don't think any of us here have ever been in a lawsuit related to our photos being stolen.
No,
I haven't been in that situation, but I think at the end of the day, you know, a lawyer's letter is a pretty pretty strong message to send. I think most people would probably conform to whatever you're asking for with a cease and desist letter.
Yeah, and generally in terms, I mean, I've dealt with this in terms of pages stealing content from my sites, in terms of photos being used. I will throw one thing in there. Professional Photographers of America, they won't give you legal counsel, but they will go in and they have, you know, they have legal staff and stuff that deals with this stuff. So first of all, they can pretty much clarify your questions if something comes down. You know, what's going to happen in this situation? What do I need to do? So that's kind of a nice connection to have. If you're a member of PPA, you can just call and chat with them. The other thing is, when I dealt with this a few years ago of somebody blatantly taking an image, using it on their site without permission, and then saying they would take it down and then going back and using it again, PPA, as I talked about back then, they drafted a legal letter, you know, similar to like a lawyer would send them, and they sent them this official letter saying, hey, this is what's going on, and you're asking for it, basically. I mean, I'm certainly not reading that verbatim, but that's kind of the gist of it. And it had an effect. I mean, the people kind of freaked out on me, like, what are you doing having them send us letters and all this stuff? And it definitely had an effect on how they reacted. So it never went to court or anything like that. I mean, I was asking them for $150 for use of the image, and it was, and they were balking about that and making a big deal about it. So the interesting thing is, and coming back, Joseph, to what you said, you know, they didn't seem to care. In fact, I think this image was actually registered in the copyright, and they were arguing with me saying, oh, there's nothing you can do. It doesn't matter. We found the image online. And so this is the normal consumer, as it were, not a photographer, but their webmaster used the image. And even though, as I recall, this image had been registered, it was one of my landscape pieces, they were sitting there arguing with me, telling me, you know, like, whatever, I'm just not going to pay it. We're not even going to pay your $150 fee. We'll take the image down. That's all we're going to do. We owe you nothing. So, just to kind of counterpoint what you said, some people that have that idea really have that idea regardless.
Yeah, well, there's also a difference between someone posting it online and then they can just take it down and say F you versus a newspaper or a magazine that published it in print and suddenly you can't exactly rescind that. It's out there. The damage is done and you can't undo it.
Well, there's a difference from the damages and things like that. But I mean, of course,
there's a difference for the reaction to it.
Right. In terms of how they perceive it, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I would think that that's probably true. And yet we still see magazines and stuff where people are doing this. So I don't really know what goes. I mean, I see, like, you know, a magazine will run an ad or something that's somebody's photo, and it's kind of astounds me, like, what are you thinking? But it happens. So
yeah, it just happened. Trey Ratcliffe just posted something this morning. One of his photos was posted by a magazine in newspaper in Australia, completely with no credit, no licensing, nothing.
So are they safe because they're in Australia? I mean, they're not bound by US law. So how does that work?
Well, he lives in New Zealand. I'm not sure what I have no idea what the copyright laws are there, but, right, or where he's registered the copyright, whether it's in New Zealand or whether it's here. But regardless,
there's a flippancy about it even now.
That ain't good. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how that story unfolds.
Yeah. And this is interesting. We won't go on too long. I mean, these are interesting topics. There's the gist, you know, people have asked, like, how do you do copyright? Well, you know, win, lose, or draw, that's kind of how we do copyright. And maybe we're not all. I think Joseph won here in terms of being proactive in his copyrights. But these are all things to consider. You know, look at what you're doing, think about the laws in your country, and get a plan so you know if something does come up, how you're going to respond.
Yep.
Okay. Does anybody have any, you know, one last quick lightning round? We could throw in just a quickie lightning round. We keep going too long, so let's be a little more judgmental on our time. Barry, you can time me if you want.
But, no kidding.
Any quick topics you guys want to hit on, or should I come up with one? Does anybody have one we should throw out there?
Yeah, I got a good one here. Let's go on sort of continuing the conversation we had earlier about pricing and stuff. It's a new year. It's 2013. You know, it's for most people, that's the end of their year end, comes December 31st there. The thing I always encourage photographers, especially when it comes to a new year and you're planning out the year, is make sure that you pay yourself first. That's something that so many people miss. And, you know, the end of the year comes and they're like, where's all my money? Where did it all go? You know, maybe there's some money left over. Maybe I can take a paycheck. And if you plan your year going forward to pay yourself first, I think you're going to end up in the positive.
Right on. Cool. Very cool. Anybody else have any kind of closing tips or lightning rounds they want to throw in there before we wrap up? Silence in the ranks. Okay. With that, I'm going to throw in one final lightning round because I want this show to close on kind of a high note. And we're going to step away from the business and stuff just for a moment. And I'm going to make a simple lightning round. I'm going to give everybody no more than 2 minutes, including myself. That's right, Barry. 2 minutes. Now, I know, Barry, a lot of times you go over time, and it could be a problem, but I'm going to try and keep you reined in there. Come on, Barry.
Whatever. It's nice that you're in the almighty power chair. If you want to just be that preachy, that's fine. Oh. We'll see.
Barry's looking at me with, he's making me feel guilty because I'm the one that actually goes over all the time. My topic, real quick, 2 minutes each, is how do you compose? Composition is a hard thing, and I'm going to only give us a quick one. Here's the question that I want you to answer. When you go in and you look at a scene, what are you looking at? How are you picking apart your scene and thinking about composition? Composition is one of those things that, yes, we have the rule of thirds, but there's so much subtlety that it's a lifetime of subtlety in terms of, do you play it safe and just go in the right or left third, or do you go in the higher or the lower? And beyond thirds, what do you look for in a scene in terms of thinking about how you want to compose to keep your focal point strong, draw the subject's eye to what you're trying to photograph? What do you do? So I'm going to start with you, Brian. We're going to go through, give everybody 2 minutes, and see how we do. So whenever you're ready, go ahead and go.
Okay. Well, you know, I photograph people. That's my main thing. Whether I'm photographing a family, whether I'm photographing a wedding party or a bride and groom or a business portrait. So for me, focal point is most of the time going to be a person. So I always look at the scene. The first decision I always make when I start taking the picture is it going to be environmental or is it going to be portrait? We have a dog in the scene now. This is nice. I just realized what Kevin's laughing about. So that's the first decision that I make. If it's going to be environmental, I need to make some other decisions in terms of what kind of lighting am I going to have to use? What is it? What is the scene going to say? What's the background going to say? Where do I want the subject? Is it going to be a small subject? Is it going to be, you know, up close and personal? So that's sort of, I guess, the way that I start things. I'm not really sure where else to go with this in terms of composition. It's obviously a pretty broad topic. For me, I do pay a lot of attention to things like posing, things like hand positioning, that sort of thing, because I think that those are the kinds of things in a photograph that can really ruin it very quickly, and it can take your eye away from everything else if it's an awkward pose or an awkward moment or whatever. So I do pay attention to those kinds of things. Don't know if that's as relevant to composition as maybe I had intended or you'd wanted, but no, I guess, cool.
Good stuff.
There you go.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian. And with that, let's go to Joseph. Joseph, tell us a little bit about how you kind of see your scene and plan your composition from the point of bringing your subject out and making them the best they can be.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, honestly, I don't really think about it. I don't look for a rule of thirds. I don't look for a golden mean or anything like that. I'm just shooting to what I think looks great. And I've been shooting for a really long time, and hopefully I have a reasonable idea of what works and what doesn't. And yeah, I don't really have any type of strategy or plan or, oh, make sure this is always there, and just making sure the lighting is good, obviously, looking for bad shadows, bad highlights, making sure that if the sun's coming into the lens, it's because it's intentional. You know, about the only kind of religious thing that I would say is that I almost never shoot from here standing up at full height, right? I'm almost always getting a little bit lower, a little bit higher, trying to change that point of view. You just get a little higher, a little lower than your average normal person would be. And that's about the only kind of religious thing that I have. Otherwise, it's just what looks good.
Right on. Cool. Okay. I will go ahead and go so that I meter my time, and then we'll go to Barry and let him wrap up on this one. So I go. For me, I feel like we have to define the focus to the subject, regardless of anything else. So then we get into space, composition, line, and tone, and all the things that relate to it. On the note of composition, I absolutely consider things like the golden meme, like the rule of thirds. I think I would challenge photographers to not go out there and say, I just do it. It works for me. And I'm not in any way suggesting by that you're not capable. I'm saying that what I found is the more that I have demanded of myself as I've been kind of studying classic technique over the past couple of years and kind of preaching things like zones and tone control and composition and all this kind of stuff, studying the painters, that if I really pre-visualize, visualization to me makes all the difference in the world. And that means really seeing and understanding what I'm doing, not only with the light, but yes, with the composition, with the subject. And so sometimes it's a struggle for me, but to go out there and demand of myself when I have time, which usually I do, to see what's happening with that image, to think about what I'm actually doing and why, instead of just taking the photo and then hoping out later that it comes good, I guarantee you it's gonna make your images better. When I go out to a scene, in terms of the composition, I'm gonna set up, the first thing is to truly decide what your subject is. There's one in each image, and that one may be a family, it may be a group of dogs, or it may be a mountain, but that one subject needs to be focused on. And think about the other elements in the scene. Look around your scene. This is where the visualization is coming in. You should be throwing in considerations for tone and light and all that kind of stuff. But on a compositional sense, look at where you can place your subject so that they are truly the subject. And so everything else in that scene makes them the focal point. All roads should lead to that subject. So if the subject is not the focal point, if the tree over there draws the attention more than them, they need to move, the tree needs to go, something needs to happen in terms of the positioning and the composition. The bottom line with my composition is don't be afraid to be creative, but most of all, make sure all the roads lead to your subject. And I'm out. 2 seconds over, Barry. That's not half bad. Come on.
That's fairly impressive, actually.
For me, that's pretty good. Okay, Barry, I am going to give you the bell, and you are on.
I'm going to echo on to what Brian said. Again, being a portrait wedding photographer, I am going to always look for a scene that most flatters my subject. And I'm going to place that subject in the scene so that, as you say, Gavin, the scene doesn't rob away from the beauty and the impact of that subject within the scene. And I do think a lot of photographers make that mistake. Oh, my gosh, look at that awesome, cool, beautiful tree. And they get so focused on the tree that they forget that they have to have a subject placed appropriately, posed appropriately, and lit properly. And all of a sudden, it's a nice picture of a tree with somebody that happens to be by it. Probably the biggest thing I do is I look for the less than obvious way to use elements within a scene. you know, again, we see so many photographers, they see that beautiful tree and they have to put the person right underneath the tree. I'm just as likely to have that person 100 yards away from that tree and shoot it with a 200 millimeter lens because that will, to me, give better visual impact. I just want that subject to always be the primary. I do a lot of shallow depth of field work. I control the elements in the background and make sure I don't have blown highlights coming off shiny water that just blast the poor subject and distract your eye altogether. So, and I find those things pretty quickly. I don't tend to do a lot of pre-visualization because I'm usually on a ticking time clock. And I have a session to shoot because I've got another one an hour or two later, and I can't be scratching my chin too much as I wander around. So I'm pretty focused and kind of manage to get to the get to a conclusion pretty quickly when I evaluate a scene. And I will defer the rest of my time to the group.
All right. Thank you, Barry. Good stuff. In defense of pre-visualization, you can do it in seconds. But we know Barry knows how to go out there and make it happen in a portrait. And this is some good stuff, some good input from everybody and different approaches in the way that we take this stuff on. So with that, if there's no more closing thoughts here, we're going to jump into picks of the week. I'm going to have everybody shout out and tell us a little bit about a favorite gadget or product that they're into. And we'll wrap it up for the night. So is there any other closing things anybody wants to touch on that I have missed before we go into that?
Yeah, let me echo what Barry said, contending him here. For me, and tell me if you guys feel the same way. I actually find that I photograph stronger and I come out with better images. Again, keeping in mind I'm a portrait photographer, I'm a wedding photographer, so my focus is people. Right. I would rather go into a scene almost blind than I would go into a scene that I'm completely prepared and aware of what's going on. A lot of the times I'm sitting down with a bride and groom and they say, oh, have you photographed at such and such place? I say, oh, no, I haven't been there before. And they say, oh, well, do you want to come with us to go look at it ahead of time? And almost every time I say, well, actually, I'd rather not go and look at it ahead of time because I find that I work better when I have to work on the fly like that as opposed to knowing what I'm going into. And I don't want to go into it with, you know, an algebraic approach to it. Do you guys feel the same way, or is that just something I'm crazy about?
Oh, no, I think you're right on, Brian. I totally agree. Now, familiarity of a scene or a church sure. or a place or a location has its advantages. We know where the outlets are. We know yeah. how certain things kind of work. But I totally agree with you. I love going to brand new places and discovering it and creating images that are kind of exciting that way. It's kind of boring cool. to go to the same places all the time.
Yeah, it is, right?
I don't want to be too disagreeable on this because I think we all plan our images, so I don't want to be too hardline, but I do take disagreement to a degree. I think the idea of being somehow less prepared than you could be is honestly kind of ridiculous. At the same time, I kind of understand what you're saying is, you go in and there's a sense of openness in your creativity, but I think it's dangerous to think that way. And I'm not saying we should never do it. I just think we need to be aware of that. I think that mindset can easily turn into, well, I don't have to do my homework because I'll just figure it out when I get there. And I've certainly been guilty of doing that on photos and on this podcast before. I think that regardless of whether you've been there is not what's relevant. I think what's relevant is visualizing an image makes your image better every single time. I've never seen it different. If I can sit there, whether it be for 10 minutes or an hour with my 4x5 thinking, okay, what do I want to do with that tree? But it doesn't always have to be that way. If I go out and I spend 10 minutes visualizing one thing, when I'm at that wedding next month and I have to do something in 3 seconds, that affects the way I respond and the way I make that image. Visualization can happen in 2 seconds, or maybe 1 second, or maybe a half a second. Visualization to me is a mindset of looking at your scene, taking it in, and putting the pieces together, whether fast or slow. And of course, the slower you do it, the more potential you have to refine and perhaps to fall into a stereotype of your own work. But anytime you have more time to review something, you can think about it more. But I think regardless of how much time you have, looking at your scene and visualizing is critical.
Well, I have to throw a funny story in. I actually pre-visualized a wedding portrait about 4 years ago, a church that I hadn't been to for a few years, maybe several. I really hadn't didn't know how long it had been, but they had these really, really cool stained glass windows that had this very modern kind of architecture. They weren't square. They had this beautiful rounded kind of top, and this bride explained she had this beautiful dress, and I had this beautiful shiny floor, and I talked up this window like, oh, man, this is great. I have some ideas. I brought an extra light specifically for part of how I was going to backlight that, only to arrive at the church to discover that they had built an annex on the other side of the stained glass window, which blocked all the daylight, so there was no light on the stained glass window. So my pre-visualized awesome stained glass window series was a flop because there was literally no light on the back side of the window, and there was no way I couldn't even get a flash behind the window because the building was literally right up against the stained glass. So that was a buzzkill. So
well, when I say pre-visualized, I'm not necessarily saying you have to do it years in advance. I think visualization can absolutely be walking into your scene and seeing it. But I just think, regardless of how much time you have or how many times you've been there, visualizing will always make your images better. And I just haven't seen anything otherwise. And I just want to add that I think Ansel would agree with me.
Well, Ansel's dead, so he's not on this podcast.
His tips are a lot of times, though, through me. Okay. Regardless, this has been fun. Joseph, do you have any closing thoughts for us on this topic, or are you good to go?
No, I'm good to go.
All right. Let's move into Picks of the Week and wrap this up for now. So who wants to go first in this week's Picks of the more like Picks of the Month, but we can differ on that. Okay. Brian.
Yes.
I'm guessing, based on some emails I got from you, that you are coming prepared to this one. So I might let you go first, and if anybody else hasn't have a pick, they can kind of scramble and make sure they have one.
All right. So listen, when I was coming into this, I was really hoping that a package would arrive at my door today so that I could use it as the pick of the week, and it did, and I'm so excited about it. Let me tell you, I got a Herman Miller Aeron chair in today. And let me tell you that this chair, I never thought I would say this before for a $1,000 computer chair. This is the best thing I've ever put my butt on in my entire life. And it is
really
amazing. Oh, it is the most comfortable chair. It is so ergonomic. It like forms to my body. It's got all kinds of adjustments so I can use it exactly the way that I want to use it. And I love it. So that is my product of the week.
And it costs $1,000.
And it costs $1,000.
I'm looking at this. It's very kind of industrial design. What's the big lump kind of underneath? I'm just going to put this in the live chat room here in case anybody's in there, and I'll put it in
the other one. That's the whole adjustment mechanism. So that's what controls the up, down, the tilt, the tilt limiter, the posture fit back thing, all that kind of stuff.
So everything tilts and swings.
It is a luxury brand, if there ever is a luxury brand. And they totally sell it that way. They totally present it that way. But let me tell you that I am 100% happy with every penny that I spend on this chair. It's amazing.
Interesting. Well, I'm not going to go out right now and do the buy now with one click on a $1,000 chair, but I will I will take a closer look. It looks like
take
they have a,
look.
A video there, and quality made products are
totally
a beautiful thing. So let me just make a note of that, and I will put a link to this in the show notes for those of you that are not listening live here.
You have to go to a store and try one out. Like, if you have a chance to go find a store nearby and sit in one, it's amazing.
It changes your perspective on the matter.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's interesting. Isn't it interesting that in the photo world, you know, we struggle sometimes with, you know, getting people to buy prints and getting them over that 11x14, or, you know, they just want the 8x10. And I always talk about wall prints like, oh, well, it's selling furniture. That's how we need to look at it. These guys are selling a $1,000 office chair, for heaven's sake. If someone can sell a $1,000 office chair, we can sell a $1,000 photo. I'm just saying.
Totally we can.
And we do. Okay. Barry, do you have a pick for us?
You know, I don't think I have a pick. I haven't bought anything. I don't get to I have nothing. I have nothing new that I've looked at, wanted, or lusted for. I'm just busy working and trying to pay the bills. So
how about
I guess,
vintage pick? Something that they might still be able to find new or used that's totally awesome, maybe even from the old days.
Any vintage film camera is a pick of the month.
Okay, give us your favorite vintage film camera, because you got to have a pick of the week. That's a rule. Best vintage film camera ever that somebody should go to eBay and buy, because film is in.
Well, then you may as well just go buy yourself a Hasselblad 500cm.
I've been eyeing one. I hear they're pretty good. Why is a Hasselblad? Yep. You always talk about a Hassi. Why is a Hassi so great?
If you're talking about quality products, you're not going to find a camera better built than a Hassi. You have the Carl Zeiss optics, which are superb. Every piece of glass functions and performs beautifully. They're just a beautiful, like Brian's chair, you just hold a Hasselblad, you fire it a couple of times, you wind it in your hand. It's just got a feel of quality about it. And the 500CM was the first camera that had interchangeable focusing screens that allowed you to make some changes. Apparently, my dog is thinking this podcast should come to a close. And this is Maggie, by the way. She's a very cool dog. And she loves to fish, so it's really great. She loves being in the boat with me.
For those in the audio feed, real quick, what is the breed of your dog there?
This is a Llewellyn setter.
Okay, cool. Continue.
The type of English setter. So, and yes, she has black and brown spots, and she is not a Dalmatian. So she's nice. She takes great offense to that. But, so go buy yourself a Hasselblad and check back in and let me know how you love it, because they're awesome.
Very cool. And with that, Joseph, do you got a pick of the week you can throw out there for us?
I do. Awesome. I'm going to hold it right up here. So this is the iFi card that I mentioned earlier. This is a little wireless card that you can pop into your, well, it's obviously an SD card.
Right.
Pop into your camera. And the idea here is it works like any other memory card, obviously stores your photos, but then it has a Wi-Fi transmitter in it. And through a little bit of effort, I will admit it's not the easiest thing in the world to set up, but through a bit of effort, you can have it send pictures to your computer or upload up to various social networks kind of automatically or whatever. But the key thing for me, the reason that I'm excited about it, is that I can send a photo directly to my iPhone so that I can then share it on Instagram or whatever I want to do. And because, you know, this format is becoming more and more popular, and you can't get this in a CF card.
Right.
I don't know why it has something to do with power.
I never quite understood that.
Right. I think it has something to do with power. I think there's more power delivered to the SD slot than there is to the CF slot.
Okay.
But anyway, for whatever reason, if your camera has this great, like, you know, my Canon 5D doesn't, but the Canon 1D series, at least, I guess the 1DX now is a bit different, but the previous 1D series had CF and SD. And so even with that, you could shoot RAW to the CF card, shoot JPEG, even a small JPEG to the SD, and then you could immediately send that picture over. So I've done that with, Canon 1DS Mark III, walking out with the 50mm lens and just out shooting, street shooting, and then you can pop over that image straight to your iPhone and push it straight to Instagram.
Okay, cool.
Which is really, really cool. Great. But I absolutely love this card. It's a little quirky. It's, like I said, it's a bit of a pain to set up, but it is a very, very cool little device. I'm loving having it.
Nice. Sweet. Now, can you get a micro SD in that? That would be tough to do, I think, but we're seeing an increase in micro SD cards in a lot of the smaller systems.
Are we? Oh, I hadn't noticed that.
Okay. Well, definitely along, things like GoPros, which are getting very popular, that they're all using micro SD now.
That makes sense. That's a bit of a different camera, though.
What's that?
That's a bit of a different camera. I mean, that's video, right?
Well, they're really pushing it for stills and stuff as well, too. But yes, it is geared towards video. But I think we're going to see more and more of these small cameras using a micro SD because it's actually getting really cheap and it's really tiny. So I wonder if that's you don't know if they make a micro SD.
They don't. As far as I know, they do not. Okay. I don't think they do. But okay. Yeah.
All right.
Hey, Joseph, so what kind of range does that card have from the device you're porting it to?
That's a good question. I don't know. If you're home, it just grabs onto your Wi-Fi network just like any other device would. So if you're in range of your Wi-Fi network. If you're out, what it does is it creates a Wi-Fi network that your phone would then lock onto and pull the photo over. Range on that, I really don't know, but assuming the phone is in your pocket or in your bag or something like that, it's on your person and the camera's obviously on your person as well, then it's range isn't an issue. But no, it's an interesting question. I don't know if you could have the card, say, obviously the card in your camera, but then like iPads that are scattered around a classroom or something like that. I don't know what the range would be for something like that.
Cool.
Right up.
All right, Gavin, what's your pick?
I'm going to throw a couple of quickies out there. The first one is a neat little gadget that is not entirely necessary, but incredibly, incredibly cool. And this is called the iFrogs Boost. And I've linked that in there. And the concept of this is very simple. It's a little box about 2 inches high, the size roughly of an iPhone, maybe a little bit larger. You turn on your phone and you turn this box on. You set your phone on the box and it amplifies the sound. There is no connection. There's no plug. You simply set an audio device on top of this little box that has batteries built in. And it amplifies very significantly the sound. Now, we're not talking about a huge boombox, but we're talking about taking that teeny little speaker in your phone and giving it some actual nice resonance and reverberance around the room. It's actually quite remarkable. And if for nothing else, you know, this thing's like $25. I think I got it on a Black Friday special. And I'm like, okay, I'll try this because everybody said how awesome it was. And it's kind of a neat looking minimalist black box. And you can just have it sitting on a coffee table or something. You set your phone playing music on there. I don't know how it works. It's called near field technology, but somehow it's picking up the vibrations or something from the device and amplifying those out, and it actually sounds really, really good. So
sounds like witchcraft to me, Gavin.
Well, you could be right there, and we're looking into that. My other pick that is much more photography / business related is the Brother QL570. This is one of the handiest little gadgets that I've bought this year in my studio. It's under $100, and all this is for is printing labels, but it's really neat. Let me give you an example. We send out DVDs quite a bit for the Expose Workshop. So somebody will order a DVD, and the email comes in. It says, here's the order. I copy the address, and that's all I do. I copy the address. I go down to my dock. I'm on a Mac, and I click the button, and I say print label, and I've made a little script using Automator that opens up the label printing program that came with the Brother. It pastes in whatever I copied, so whatever's on the clipboard, it pastes in this case, an address. It prints me a label, and it closes the program, and it's done. So literally, for printing a label for anything, and I realize everybody's not shipping DVDs, but we all have to ship something sometimes, and I've always kind of hated making labels. And of course, you're not going to set up a printer and a sheet of labels for one address. This is really cool because you can print as many as you want. I roast coffee at home, and I have these labels I make for my roasted coffee as well. And I'll send 20 of them there, and it'll just shoot them out. And it's just a thermal printer. You can get the tape for pretty inexpensive. You go to Amazon, and it lasts quite a while. And you can buy third-party stuff that's really good, and it's not very expensive. Bottom line is, if you need a label for anything, this thing works great. The tape comes in whatever width you choose, but then, of course, how you set up the document that you're printing, you can make a template and have it print however long. So you can control your size that way. Just black and white, of course. But this thing is worth its weight in gold. If you ever spend time sitting there scrawling out labels, this thing is worth having on your desk. It's hooked up all the time. And at any moment, I can have anything I copy of text on a label within about 10 seconds in my hand, ready to go on an envelope. And that's a time saver for me. So that's cool. Yeah. It's a neat gadget. So with that, some fun picks. Barry, I just have to resonate. Your pick of a Hasselblad this week is good because you can actually go out, buy a Hasselblad with an 80 millimeter on there, and you'll be out less money than you would buy to go buy the latest, you know, NEX7 or something like that. And you have a legendary, awesome camera that uses film.
That's true.
It's a great film is a better value than people realize. With that, I think we are going to close out for the day. You guys can shout out, let people know where they can find you. I want to thank you all for joining us. We had a small group in the live room this week. I don't know where they were all at. I think people were busy, and that's okay. And it's been a fun one. My wife shouted out in the chat room. Sandra says that her pick is Snap Circuits, and we got one of these for my son for his birthday. If you have children, or if you are a child like me, you definitely want to go buy Snap Circuits. I don't want to take too much time. Go Google it, look it up. They are super cool. You tinker and build with electronics. They're great for kids. They're great for the mind. And I kind of bought it for my son for his birthday because I wanted to play with it too, because they're that awesome. Snap Circuits, check them out. Okay. Thank you all. Barry, where can people find you? I know you've been doing some good blog posts and got some stuff going over there. Where can they check out the words of Barry?
Well, just go to pictureplace.com. My blog is there. And from there, my Twitter handle is fstop95. I kind of go on and off with Twitter, but every once in a while I get inspired and tweet away a little bit. But other than that, keep it simple.
Excellent, excellent. And Brian, where can we find you on the intergalactic web?
Well, you can find the portal for everything, I guess, for me is bcapphoto.com.
BCAP, I like how that rolls off.
bcapphoto.com. Also, just a quick shameless plug there. I mentioned earlier I co-wrote a book, Pricing for Profit. If you visit amazon.com, you can just search Pricing for Profit there. And it's written by myself and another photographer.
Very cool. It sounds like you have lots of things going on, lots of cool projects, which is awesome.
BCAP, I keep
you busy. Yeah, that's great. BCAPphoto.com. By the way, I have to give you plugs for using the web address BCAPphoto. I don't know if you did that the first time around, because when I was early in my websites, I would have these terrible domain names. We've talked about this in the past, but your last name, suffice to say, is not real easy to spell, just like hearing it over the air. And it... Caparishi, or no, that's Japanese. That's not right, is it?
It's close.
In any case, I still have a hard time with it. So it was very smart for you not to have that in your domain name.
Yeah, for sure.
Even though it would be cool to have a domain name. Do you own BrianCaparishi.com?
I probably should register it though. Now,
eh? Maybe you should have it just as a forum, but it's not like anybody's ever going to spell it right anyhow. So
yeah,
I don't know. Okay, Joseph, thanks for joining us. Good to have you on again. And where can they find you? I know you got lots of projects going as well. What's the easiest way for people to check out what you're doing?
Well, fortunately, the easiest way is not trying to spell my last name, even though I do have josephlenashke.com. That was retired quite some time ago. So photojoseph.com. Photo Joseph is everywhere. That's the Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. It is the everything for the world of photography for me. And then, of course, if you're an Aperture user, check out apertureexpert.com. And awesome. So we're doing shameless plugs. I've just released a new training, kind of an addendum training for Aperture 3 that brings you up to date with Aperture 3.3 to 3.4. It's very affordable. Check that out.
Apertureexpert.com. And they can download those videos, or what do you got going with those?
It's all downloadable. It's all downloadable, streaming, whatever you need. Just head on over there. You'll see it.
Head over and check it out and get your Aperture training in. And for the record, it's good to know both Aperture and Lightroom. So even if you're an Aperture user, it can't hurt to go spend a little time in Aperture. Even if you're a Lightroom user, rather, it can't hurt to spend some time in Aperture. Okay. Thank you. Thank you all. As always, guys, you can find me and all my projects, my social networks, all that kind of stuff, simestudios.com. That's my home portal. See what I'm doing, and follow me on my coming trip. We're loading up the family in the super camper. You can learn about that on my website. Most of that stuff's on f164.com, but we're loading up in about a week, and we are taking off for 3 months and going to be traveling, doing pictorials, working on some new educational projects, and of course, blogging and Twittering and all that. So you can find out all that stuff over at simestudios.com. At Gavin Syme on Twitter. And check out my new project. I have lots of projects going on, but if you've not subscribed to my light letter yet, that's a fun one. That's kind of my personal newsletter. We do a newsletter with Syme effects and tips and new products and stuff like that. But the light letter is something that I took on to kind of get back into the newsletter game, since Facebook and stuff is kind of fading. And I show my latest photos, I talk about where I'm going and stuff, but we also take some time off and we look at interesting things. We look at art and photo history, and we just kind of look at some anecdotal stuff in terms of looking at art and photography and different interesting things. I think you'll enjoy it. Check it out at lightletter.com, lightletter.com. It's totally free, and it's a pretty fun little newsletter that comes out once every few weeks, every month or so, something like that. You're not going to get spammed by it. So check it out at lightletter.com, and all my stuff at simestudios.com. With that, thank you all for joining us. It's been really fun. You can find the show notes for this episode and lots of articles and tips and content and forums over at profotoshow.net. Head over and check it out. And we hope to see you here next time. Thank you all. Joseph, good to have you back. Thank you, Barry, for being here. And Brian, good to have you. First time on the show. It was great having you. And we'll have to have you on again sometime. So thank you all.
Thanks,
and
guys.
With that, we will bid the listeners a good night and swing over right here into... We actually are still live, so don't say anything crazy, but the show is officially over. If we say anything cool here, it becomes after show. If we say dumb stuff, it becomes nothing, and it just becomes...
If we say dumb stuff, it becomes the highlight, right?
If somebody besides me says dumb stuff, it becomes at the front of the show to highlight the opening scenes.
All right.
Hey, thank you all. And that's a nice... Brian, your webcam is very pixelated, but it looks like a very nice environmental portrait there you have in the background.
Oh, yeah. It's that's actually a couple years old, but...
I see a sunset and a bride and a groom. It looks like they're in white. And I see what appears to be tone control, and I immediately am struck by that. And that's cool. It's very pixelated, but it looks like this is HDR because there's a lot of dynamic range, but it looks like this with strobes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, but what I'm saying is that is HDR because you have dynamic range, but it's not HDR bracketed.
The picture itself is pixelated, so it's not just the webcam.
Your webcam, I think, is about like 200 by 200 pixels right now, but it looks like a beautiful portrait. And I have to say, you know, we were talking about different compositions and stuff. I absolutely adore a good environmental portrait. To me, that's
for sure
the best part about making portraits, and it's largely what I do, sometimes tighter, sometimes wider, but whether it's outside or in somebody's office or whatever, to me, like, one of the biggest challenges of making a portrait is doing something beautiful with an environmental portrait, because you have to have mastery over your light and your tone. Otherwise, you just have a chaotic mess. Is anybody else here a Norman Rockwell fan?
Sure.
It's amazing to me. Norman Rockwell, and you probably know this, but he was actually a really good photographer. And there's a book about that shows his paintings, and then it shows the reference photos he would take. And he would do these very intricate setups and have all this lighting and have a crew there. And to do the reference photos, he wouldn't just take a snapshot for his reference photos. He would set it up all technically and scientifically and do these really neat photographs that represented fairly close the scene he was intending to paint. And it's actually very interesting to see them side by side. But clearly that was helping him reference, and he must have used that to help him visualize his scene. But if you are doing environmental scenes, meaning environmental, like a person, let's say, in an environmental scene where you have trees, or maybe you have somebody's living room or something like that, he's a really good guy to look at, because Norman Rockwell would have these ridiculously busy scenes. I mean, there would be so much going on. You know, a dog would be like jumping up and biting the mailman, and the kid would be like spilling ice cream down his shirt, and mom would be yelling. And he would do these very complex scenes, and yet it was chaos without complete chaos. Your eye still went exactly where he wanted it to go, and it was led through the scene. And it really is remarkable the way that he used his tone and his line and pulled that together. There's really something to be learned there, and it's worth taking a look at. For those of you that don't already have a stack of Norman Rockwell books next to your Ansel Adams book.
All right, guys. Hey, I'm sorry. I do have to get off.
No problem, Joseph. We are officially over. So,
I'd be so.
You bet. Hey, thanks for joining us. Till next time, and you take care over there.
Yep, I'm signing off too. I got a dog that's very anxious to go for a walk.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
Okay, guys.
Even though it's 4 below right now, I'm still taking
4 below. What's wrong with you guys over there? 4 below.
Is that it?
Yeah. What's we're 40 below right here.
Last weekend.
it's up.
It was 15 below Monday.
Yeah, we had the same thing here. It was brutal.
Now, when you have 15 below and then like a 30-mile-an-hour wind, that's like...
really cold.
That's getting really cold. But I guess for you, I remember you last year, Barry, complaining because it was too warm and the ice hockey rinks were melting.
That's true.
So,
we had some of that problem, but, you know.
And those of you from Canada, you're into hockey up there too, right?
Yeah.
It's a
national sport, right?
It occurs to me that maybe it's all you can do because it's always so cold up there. You don't really have like this warm winter. I mean, it's always freezing up there.
And... Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all we have, Gavin. We have igloos everywhere, and all we do
that's
is
all. I remarked to my wife earlier this morning, actually. This is ironic. I didn't even click with me that you were from up there, but I said, what is wrong with Canadians? All they have is hockey. I mean, at least we do they have a sport where they go out on the ice and they beat the crap out of each other. We have sports where we like throw a ball around.
You have a sport where you go on a field and beat the crap out of each other. What's the difference, right?
Well, baseball's pretty mundane, but I guess there's football. But the thing is, football, with hockey, the difference is with hockey, you go there to see people beat the crap out of each other.
Yes, this is true.
Not true with the college game, so. Yeah.
Not true with the how about with like the high school and middle school games?
No, they don't allow fighting there, so that's more of a pro thing. But we have a lot of hockey here in Minnesota. Although this weekend we have either of you guys ever seen the Red Bull crashed ice?
We just had it here in Niagara Falls like a few months ago.
Very cool. It's coming back to St. Paul for the second time. It was here last year for the first time, and it's just an insane. Gavin, you've never seen anything like it.
This is something.
It's guys that are basically in full hockey gear that skate down this very steep, very fast, narrow track,
wow,
four at a time, and they kind of fly around this course and go over bumps and jumps and knock each other around, and whoever finishes wins. And
this
they
sounds like
light
some
it.
Canadians would do.
Exactly. It's an international crazy. It's a beautiful St. Paul Cathedral, and they start right up by the cathedral. And I actually know somebody who works for the Archdiocese, and I was like, wow, isn't that a big deal? They have to shut the cathedral down for the whole weekend and can't do church. And she said, are you kidding me? She goes, the Archdiocese makes so much money off that, because that's not very many people go to a cathedral for church. So it's like a huge moneymaker now for them to not have church all weekend. And it's a beautiful spectacle. I'll try and send you some pictures after. I'm going to try and go down and shoot it, I think.
I mean, money's a great reason to stop having church, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. That's interesting, though. No, I don't think I've ever seen a hockey game. There is a hockey league around here that's kind of a local one, and some people are into it. I've never been a very good spectator of sports. If I'm not out there either beating or being beat, I tend to get bored. But it's interesting. Hockey, admittedly, there is a definite interest in a game where people are encouraged to go beat each other up. It's just a little weird.
Well, I think in fairness to the sport, Gavin, I think you probably need to watch it a little bit. Yes, there are some hockey fights, and the crowds do love the fights.
I have watched some of the videos on YouTube that were like professional hockey games.
Because that's all they put on YouTube.
Yeah, well, I realized that, but it was still a sanctioned sport. I realize this doesn't happen every game, but it was pretty ridiculous. I mean, they were totally encouraging the fighting, and they were after they've beaten on each other for a while, the refs go out there and kind of vainly pretend like they want to break it up. They're like, hey, stop that. Stop beating the crap out of each other, you guys. I mean, it's let's put it this way. If you were at a Major League Baseball game and two guys went out there and started trying to beat each other up, it would not be responded to in the same way.
That's the same thing as saying, hey, listen, I've watched a whole bunch of YouTube videos on cats running into walls. I'm not going to buy a cat now because all they do is run into walls.
Well, Brian, when I get free tickets to the Stanley Cup, I'll call you, not Gavin.
There you go. Right on. Okay, I'm going to sign
all
out,
right,
guys. A wife waiting for me. So I'll talk to you guys later. Thanks again, Gavin.
See you later.
Take care. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Bye.
Till next time. And with that, we are out. Thank you all. I'm ending the broadcast officially. After I end this show, after I close out this window, I'm going to yodel. Goodbye. Hello, doo doo. No, that's terrible. Don't, Nathan. Don't include that. Don't include that. All right. Hello, la la doo, la la doo, la doo, la.